It's ironic, really, because the rest of us are being forced to ease off our literal gas pedals because petrol prices make driving almost unaffordable. This is a worldwide crisis. Since many of you went to bed, by the way, Donald Trump has threatened to bomb more bridges in Iran and electric power plants in what appears to be a new push for Tehran to sign a deal. It could also be a war crime, by the way. Why does Trump take no time off? Not even over Easter. He's still at it. Just the post this morning. Our military, the greatest and most powerful anywhere in the world, hasn't even started. I thank you for your attention to this matter. Come and join me.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Marks and Spencer is urging the government to do more to tackle a rise in retail theft and violence. It follows incidents of so-called link-ups, where groups of young people arrange to meet using social media before surging into shops. A number of dispersal orders have been put in place across the country. Head of External Affairs at Marks and Spencer, Adam Hawksby, says it's very worrying.
Some incidents will be serious and organised crime. Others will be individuals that are under the influence of alcohol and drugs. And this can be really scary, both for our colleagues working in the store and for the security guards. We've had ammonia thrown in the face of one of our security guards in the last week. We've had a store manager headbutted.
The Home Office says it is giving police stronger powers. President Trump has said there's much more to come after the US bombed Iran's largest bridge. Iranian state media say 8 people were killed. The White House has defended US actions in the war after 100 legal experts raised concerns of serious violations from all sides. The US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has sacked the Army Chief of Staff Randy George. Since entering the Pentagon, Mr. Hegseth has fired more than a dozen senior officers. It's understood he's looking to appoint personnel who will implement the Trump administration's vision for the army. The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, is reportedly considering approving the first major North Sea oil and gas field project in almost 10 years. Ministers are under pressure to increase drilling due to energy concerns around security triggered by the Middle East conflict. A government spokesman says no decision has been made. And the Orion capsule carrying the astronauts aboard the Artemis 2 mission is now officially on its way to the moon. The 4 astronauts on board fired its engine to free the capsule from Earth's gravitational pull overnight. Laurie Glaze leads the Artemis program and has given this update.
For the first time since 1972, during Apollo 17, human beings have left Earth orbit. From this point forward, the laws of orbital mechanics are going to carry our crew to the moon, around the far side, and back to Earth.
LBC weather, windy with scattered showers for many areas, some sunny spells and some showers in the north and east, a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Get 25% off coffee and pastries at Cafe Nero with Comparsa Market. Take it away, Sergei.
I need a Nero. I'm holding out for a Nero to get a flat white. It's gotta be strong, and it's gotta taste good, and it's gonna be made just right. I need a Nero.
Only with the Compare the Market app, the simplest way to save.
When you take out a qualifying product, 1 membership a year, 25% off barista-made drinks and pastries, app only, 2 codes per day, exclusions and T's and C's apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Matt Fry.
Surprise, surprise, and a very good morning to all of you. You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you, goes the old saying, loosely attributed to Leon Trotsky. What started as a surgical strike on one supreme leader in Tehran and a dawn of bombardment in a war of choice has rippled out to become an economic war of necessity, triggering fuel shortages and emergency plans across the world. It has divided allies, threatened the future of NATO, made China look like the world's designated driver, made Russia a lot richer, and kept the brutal regime in Tehran in power, resilient, emboldened, and able to threaten its neighbours like never before, while having a chokehold on the world economy through the Strait of Hormuz, which it has threatened to turn into a Tehran toll booth. Operation Epic Fury, as the Pentagon dubbed it in a spirit of hubris, looks more like blind fury. and we're all forced to take an interest. Just listen to what Donald Trump said about the objectives nearing completion when he was speaking from the White House yesterday.
Tonight, I'm pleased to say that these core strategic objectives are nearing completion. Tonight, every American can look forward to a day when we are finally free from the wickedness of Iranian aggression and the specter of nuclear blackmail. Because of the actions we have taken, we are on the cusp of ending Iran's sinister threat to America and the world. And I'll tell you, the world is watching. And when we do, when it's all over, the United States will be safer, stronger, more prosperous, and greater than it has ever been before.
And the world is indeed watching, but mostly from behind the sofa. And as for those reasons for going to war that he outlined in an Oval Office address on February the 28th, the day the bombing started, well, they seem to be veering all over the place, a bit like a shopping trolley. So that makes it much more difficult for him to claim some kind of victory. And to claim victory while the Iranians still control the Strait of Hormuz and therefore the flow of oil and gas and many other things like fertilizer to the world economy, well, that's not really victory, is it? Let's speak to Natasha Churak. She's an independent Middle East correspondent based in Dubai. Good morning, Natasha.
Good morning to you, Matt.
It's good to speak to you again. I'm fascinated by how Dubai and indeed the other Gulf states are faring in all this, because I don't think, you know, although Trump has apologized to them for the fact that they've been hit by Iran, I don't think he fully understood the degree to which the Iranian regime would take it out on their neighbors in the Gulf in order to put pressure on America. So what's the situation like at the moment in Dubai? How does it feel to be there?
So things certainly feel tense. It's not the same as it used to be. And for those of us who lived here for a while, nobody saw this coming. The UAE has long been a very safe, stable country in a region that has seen its fair share of conflict. I would say in the day to day, people who've chosen to stay here, which is the majority of us, do feel safe in the sense that we know the air defenses are very effective. Infrastructure is still working perfectly. You know, I went to the beach over the weekend and it was so crowded that I couldn't even find parking. You know, people are still going shopping, going to restaurants. But of course, it feels more tense. It's quieter. There's a lot less traffic on the roads. Tourism is dramatically reduced. And so that has had an effect on local businesses. And, you know, for those of us who live here, our families overseas are constantly texting us, do you have a plan? Are you going to come home? Are you going to stay? For me personally, I still feel very comfortable to stay. And as a journalist, it's important for me to be here at this historic time for the region. But things are certainly tense. Just this morning, I was at the gym and everyone's phones went off at the same time with the missile alerts. Mm. And I will say, actually, sometimes the missile alerts on the phones are more startling than the booms themselves.
Well, I know, but I've just been to Israel for a few weeks and it's, you know, there are alerts all the time and they really get under your skin, and you then have to think very carefully about whether you stay in the gym or wherever you are, or go down to the bunker. In Israel, there's a lot of discipline. People tend to go to the bunker, and that's why they have very few injuries. I'm sure something similar is happening in Dubai. But to those, you know, in a spirit of schadenfreude who thought this is the end of the Dubai dream, I think they were wrong, weren't they? I mean, those places are a lot more resilient than a lot of people give them credit for.
I think they were wrong. And we have a lot of stories of countries and of cities enduring war and coming out stronger. Look, the UAE endured COVID. They endured the 2008 financial crisis. It endured the invasion of Kuwait, the Gulf Wars 1 and 2. And I think the people who are committed to the UAE, you know, it's 90% expats in this country. Most of us are committed because we came here because of what it offers us in terms of business friendliness, in terms of the tax setup, in terms of safety, in terms of 350 days a year of sunshine and being a travel logistics hub. And it's also a very diverse place to live. You have people from all over the world, all sorts of different kinds of backgrounds, professionally, ethnically, linguistically. Just, you know, in January, February, March, you know, you have Nowruz, Ramadan, the Lunar New Year. You know, you have beautiful Indian holidays, Diwali. You have all these holidays happening at the same time. I would say just in terms of quality of life and in terms of the richness of diversity, those things aren't going to change. So I think with its kind of pragmatic strategy as it's approaching this conflict right now and its technology, its alliances, so far things seem to be under control. Obviously, the risks don't stop and they could get worse. But I do feel that it will bounce back from this.
But if you take pictures of any of the damage or of missiles kind of being intercepted by interceptors, you're also liable to end up in jail. Does that bother you as an independent journalist living there?
Well, certainly it is something that has made people pause and very much made people change their minds when it comes to sharing information. Now, I think from a journalist perspective, obviously, yes, it is restrictive. At the same time, this is a country who's making its choices based on its number one priority, which is security. And so, you know, if you're taking pictures of an intercept, there are ways for our adversaries to take that and to triangulate it and to use technology to figure out where the interceptors are, right, and you know where those missile batteries are. And that's something that anyone living here doesn't want to happen, because that puts us all in danger. So it is definitely something that has given people a lot of pause and a bit more tension. Sometimes people are a bit scared, for sure. But I think it's also, you just ultimately, you have to respect the rules of the country you're living in.
Indeed. And I mean, is it about, you know, the strategic fears that you're giving away too much intelligence here? Or is it about the image of Dubai being tarnished in the public space?
It could certainly be both. I think there is, I think the priority is for security and to keep these, and operational security, keeping this information as inaccessible to Iran as possible. But certainly there's also a thought toward stability, toward keeping people calm, and toward, you know, these images that have come out in the press of, you know, buildings on fire and drones hitting parking lots and people running and screaming. Obviously, it does not, it's not good for any country's image. And while these things happened, I think there is a penchant in the West to exaggerate it. And so people will take these images and say, oh my gosh, look, this whole place is on fire. There are missiles constantly falling from the sky. And if you're here, it just isn't, like, these things are happening, but not to the extent that it dominates our day-to-day lives in the way that the press would like you to believe. So there is, like, there is image management, but it's also, I think, for the greater prioritization of stability more broadly.
I mean, I think it's true to say of all wars that if you're actually living in it, whether it's Ukraine or Israel after October the 7th, or Iran, even Iran at the moment, with, you know, where there's much more bombing going on than anywhere else in the region, you kind of, you know, normality, you know, is in your face more than you'd imagine it when you're watching the news from abroad. I think that's true, unless you're right in the middle, unless you're really unlucky and you're right next to an airstrike, or, you know, in places like Gaza where it's intense across the region. I get your point here, but I just wonder whether in the future Dubai and indeed the other Gulf states will just have to think very differently about what they can offer to expats and how they protect themselves. I mean, they're going to live in a new kind of normal, aren't they?
They are, and I think this very much depends on the outcome of this conflict. Now, if we come to a ceasefire with Iran, where it's, you know, the same government is in place, everything is as normal, but the guns stop firing, I think there will remain a lot of tension and a lot of discomfort, because you never know when things can kick off again, whether it's from Iran's side or whether it's from Israel's side, provoking Iran or the U.S. the same way. So I think that will remain very tense unless there is a genuine change in the leadership in Iran and a change in the force posturing of that country. Because I think if it stays the way it is, it will continue to be something that keeps leaders in this region up at night. And that is something that, of course, the people who want to come and invest here will remember. But at the same time, you still have people coming here. I mean, for the most part, everyone is still objectively quite safe. There have been, I believe at this point, 11 fatalities, very, very unfortunate and tragic. But we're talking about a country of 10 million people. I think statistically, you're more likely of getting hurt doing your morning commute on the highway than if you are just going about your day and you know, working from home. So I think they will have to be offering different things and you know, ensuring people that, look, we still have control over the situation. There is still security, but it very much depends on how the conflict itself pans out and how it concludes.
And tell me, does the UAE take the view that it's better to do a deal with this regime, even though it hasn't changed fundamentally? I mean, there's still a guy called Khamenei running it. He's, you know, the Nepo Ayatollah. He's Khamenei Jr. He still has some of the hardcore of the Revolutionary Guard very much, in fact, more in charge probably than they were before. Can they live with this regime doing a deal with America? Or do they still think that regime change, genuine regime change, is necessary? And how do they bring that about?
Yeah, so I can't speak for the government here. I can't really speak to their exact desires and intentions. Now, we have had a range of reports that say, that allege that the government here does want to see regime change or does want to see a much more forceful push by the United States to really defeat and to change the leadership of Iran. But when this was predominantly in an article from the Wall Street Journal. Now, when the article came out, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here denied it. So we don't really have clarity on what exactly the government here wants with respect to Iran. But there definitely have been many reports concerning both the Saudi Arabia and the UAE that there is a desire for a much more sort of a hardline approach against Iran to ensure that it cannot be a threat to the Gulf states in the region anymore.
And from what you can tell, because the government there doesn't tell you everything that you want to know necessarily, do you think they would be prepared to put their own boots on the ground in Iran if it came to a land invasion to secure the strait? What's your reading?
I don't know. I can't.
What's your best guess? I know you're not speaking for the government. What's your best guess?
I don't see it. I don't see it because I think the blowback to the UAE in terms of continued attacks or escalated attacks would be very intense. The U.S. has the advantage when it comes to numbers. So I don't know. Perhaps when it comes to... I really can't say.
Okay, all right. A final one, perhaps an easier one. I mean, who are they angry with? I'm not just talking about the government, but people in Dubai. Are they angry with the Iranians for making their life more difficult? Are they angry with Israel and the United States for having kicked the hornet's nest without the right kind of protection? Who are they angry with?
So there's definitely a mix, and it depends who you speak to. I think there is definitely, among ordinary people, there's a lot of frustration with the U.S. and Israel, who a lot of people say started this. But they're very, very quickly that became acute anger at Iran, because Iran is the one who is firing missiles and drones at this country. So I think the more acute fear and anger is toward Iran, especially among locals, but among the general population, there is still a lot of displeasure and anger at the U.S. and Israel as well, because the UAE never asked to be in this situation at all.
And do you think that feeling is replicated across the Gulf? I mean, we tend to lump them all together, but they all have slightly different attitudes, don't they? Kuwait,
absolutely,
Bahrain,
and generationally there are different attitudes.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, across the region, it really varies. I think there are some countries like Qatar in particular would have had, or Oman would have had more sympathy toward Iran. But now that they are coming under Iranian attack, there is definitely frustration with the U.S. and Israel. But at the same time, the U.S. Air defenses are the ones that are protecting them. So they almost have no choice but to be like, okay, like, the U.S. are the ones protecting us. Iran is the one attacking us. We're mad at everyone for putting us in a situation we never asked for and we have nothing to do with. But, you know, one country is the one firing its missiles at us and the other ones aren't.
Is the airport open, by the way, for business?
I believe so.
Good. That's excellent. Fantastic.
Yeah. Sure. People are traveling in and out. I know people who are going in and out at the moment. And, sometimes you have to wait on the tarmac. Sometimes you deplane and come back on the plane. But for the most part, it's, planes are flying.
Okay. Natasha Churak, independent Middle East correspondent based in Dubai. Thank you very much indeed. It's time for the break.
LBC.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades. And why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which? A record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
Why do we say older people are stuck in their ways? Are their shoes glued down? Why should they slow down? Will their batteries run out? Why do bosses want young blood? Are they vampires?
Ageism sounds absurd, doesn't it? But those negative comments and assumptions add up, limiting work, health, and who's valued? Will you question it so we can all age without limits? Ageism. Question it. Challenge it. Change it. Agewithoutlimits.org.
Fancy a trip to France without the fancy price tag? Go all Irish. With great low prices, travel from Dover to Calais with Irish ferries and you'll have France at your feet in 90 minutes. Can-can. Less. More money, less money. You get the picture. Get a warm Irish welcome on board and a cool pint of the black stuff on us. Zero alcohol, of course. When you book direct at irishferries.com. Escargot on then. Irish ferries. See travel differently. T's and C's apply.
From the big transformations to the small home improvements, you can feel as proud as a peacock with Wix.
Apply.
Matt Fry on LBC.
What's so fascinating about this war is not just the morality or immorality behind it, not just the fuzziness over the war aims, not just the fact that it's causing huge tensions inside President Trump's MAGA camp, big tensions within NATO, the Chinese are kind of perplexed on the sidelines, wondering whether it's made them look even more like the designated adult than before. They're offering predictability, but, you know, it's the iron embrace of Xi Jinping as opposed to the once more cuddly embrace of Uncle Sam. The Russians can't believe their luck. The sanctions have been lifted against them. The price of oil is going up. They're making more money in order to keep their war against Ukraine going. We've just heard from the Gulf. I mean, there's so many, there's such a multi-layered millefeuille of opportunities and disasters, let alone Iran itself. I mean, once upon a time, this was about regime change, and it isn't anymore, as far as we can tell. But then, of course, there's the military aspect. And we all talk about the Strait of Hormuz as if we always thought about nothing else, and suddenly everyone, you know, even kids are talking about Hag Island around the water cooler at school, which I'm sure is a place they've never heard of before. I certainly hadn't heard of it until, or hadn't been interested in it until a few months ago. And you kind of wonder what the military options are, because most wars end with some degree of political, you know, accord. A deal has to be signed. And that we seem to be quite far away from that. So let's talk to Robert Fox, as we often do in these straight times about the Strait. Defence editor of the Evening Standard. Robert, good morning to you. Happy Easter.
Yeah, same to you, Matt. Good morning.
There's so much to talk about, so let's get cracking. Militarily, if you had to sum up where we are in a kind of double espresso of analysis, what would you say?
I would say that we're in the 21st century of a strategic and tactical Rubik's Cube, and the bits aren't fitting. Because it's quite clear from the Trump-Netanyahu side, the thing is not going to plan. I think he wanted a quick excursion, as you say. He outlined all these things, if you remember, the 28th of February. He said, yeah, rise up, people of Iran, regime change. We're here to help, and we'll get rid of all those strategic and tactical missiles and drones and the nuclear threat. Well, not one of those four or five has been fulfilled completely. There's been a semi-regime change, but it's back to the future, and it's a tougher version of what we had before. And we've got a resilient Iran, and the trouble is that they're pulling the military levers and pressing the buttons, and they're going bing or splat or whatever. And they're pretty desperate, because I think we're looking at them running out of their strategic missiles if they're not careful. By that I mean things which have strategic effect,
yeah,
like Patriot and so on. Look at the aircraft carriers they're calling up. They're things that are almost as old as you and me being called into service, like the Nimitz and the Eisenhower. You know, the Nimitz is 60 years old. It's a real haulix, this, and it is quite unpredictable. And as I have written this morning in the Eye, we need to have a bit of a sense of damage control and see where we can go from here. And I think everybody's got to look at that now.
Indeed. And I just wonder, you know, you've covered so many wars for such a long time, Robert, since Clausewitz. No, I'm kidding. You're not that old. But you've been around the block a few times. Have you ever seen a war of choice that has been conducted with such fuzziness? and such ambiguity with such ill-defined goals? Is this unprecedented or not?
It is unprecedented, and it's because of a phenomenon that I know that you and I have written and broadcast about. And it's the way that, you know, normally, as I said, you build up when you plan for a big operation like this, you do war games, you game war. No, what we're hearing in the language, and it's the way they think with somebody like Hegseth, it's the gamification of war. Mm. This is why the language of IRW in the real world is very different from video game language. And that's why we've even had down to, you know, lethal maxing, wham, and, you know, the kind of cartoonish output of the statements of the White House and the Pentagon. Yes, it is a very different dimension, but the trouble is it's unpredictable. There are a lot of known unknowns out there. I was very interested in your depiction of Russia. No, I think Russia, gosh, is in a very, very difficult situation. If you look at the war front in Ukraine, what is happening with Russian industry, and I think that Russia is likely to behave completely unpredictably, and we're not factoring that in at the moment.
No. Indeed, and maybe China's looking at this and saying, I mean, I honestly don't think that Xi Jinping, who is, I think, a naturally cautious fellow, will do something as rash as Trump has done. And, you know, this is, again, another example for him of rashness to be avoided. So I don't think he's about to launch an invasion of Taiwan. But, I mean, he must be thinking, you know, there's an opportunity here. If they're busy fighting wars they didn't need to fight in the Middle East, it makes it more easy for me, at least, you know, to breathe a sigh of relief over Taiwan for the foreseeable future. I just wonder, Robert, whether you think that the fundamental problem that America comes across is that it's almost a victim of its own kind of military precision success. They think that wars are won with smart bombs, and that makes for some very unsmart decisions.
When you have wars among the people, and that is what this is, whether you're quoting Mao Zedong or our old friend Rupert Smith, who wrote the book for the British Army, The Utility of Force, wars among the people, and we're talking about a very big amount of people, if I can use Trump's simplicity on this, 91 million. You cannot do it from the air. This is where, when Keir Starmer said that very simple thing, you can't do regime change from the air, he was absolutely right. And this is where I think we're going about to tip over. We're at a tipping point where we're about to get into a very strange passage now, particularly as both America and the Israelis seem to be winding themselves up to a ground operation in or on Iran.
Do you think that's going to happen?
I think there are so many problems. And were I to be a planner, and having done some courses to see how planners plan, I wouldn't go near it. But I'm quite shocked, as of talking to various people over the last 36 hours, how likely they think it is. By that, I think it's British military analysts and so forth. And it is so risky. I think Karg Island trying to militarize the opening of the Straits of Hormuz, whether you do it with armed convoys, whether you do it by putting commandos ashore either side of the straits, I think it's almost a no-no. The risk is beyond 90% because you're so exposed doing that. Again, it's a reflex that doesn't seem to have been entirely thought through, at least not as far as the White House is concerned.
I interviewed Sir Patrick Sanders, General Sir Patrick Sanders, the other day for my Channel 4 podcast, The Forecast, and he is a very wise soldier, and I'm sure you know him very well. And he said, we're looking at the way that the American troops have been deployed, and the Marines on their way, you know, these are very effective fighting forces, but their deployment is above all reactive. It's Trump reacting to something that didn't go according to his short-term plans. And that kind of reactiveness, although inevitably part of warfare, you know, is not a good idea if that's the way you operate, because you get sucked into something that you didn't foresee. Do you see it that way as well?
Yes, it is. And that's where I've drawn the analogy with Vietnam. That's how Vietnam started, with packets of forces to support a very, very crapulous, by that I mean falling apart and corrupt regime in Saigon. And so it went on. And so you got hundreds of thousands going there. And this is the kind of logical illogic that's going on at the moment. Completely agree with Patrick. It was not in even the sketchy original plan that Trump had through February preparing for this, and it's committing one of the biggest sins in the military playbook, reinforcing failure.
And I guess the problem also with Trump is that because he's not curious about history or about, you know, the intellectual or political hinterland of a country, he doesn't care about the context, and nor do all the kind of sycophants in the White House, especially Pete Hegseth, who is such an action man, disgraceful action man of war, with that appalling language, and frankly dripping with insults for America's allies. Because they don't see it that way, they don't understand the power of resilience, the fact that regime change is not, achieved by just getting rid of one person. They don't understand that actually Venezuela wasn't regime change. I mean, Delcy Rodriguez was the vice president and she's in charge, and so are the rest of the hard men who've run Venezuela for over a decade. So they just don't get it. And if they don't get it, they can't really plan accordingly.
I think that's a very strong statement. I couldn't but agree with every syllable of what you've just said, Matt, because if you look at the record from Venezuela through even the crazy threats, and they became crazier over Greenland, what they have done, even with Gaza, seeing it through to getting a proper stabilization force in there, getting the Gaza plan, it's all half-baked. They're all incomplete. And that's what we're looking at here. But the trouble is with this one is that it's entanglement.
Yes.
To quote the latest in physics, he's not going to be able to get out of this one so easy.
But he may want to. I mean, he may declare victory and then walk away from it all. That's the fear in Israel. And leave the regime in place, emboldened, hardened, you know, even more ideological than before. And of course, all they need to do to claim victory is to still be alive.
Yes, exactly. And they can go again. They're in a terrible situation. Think of the situation that started the demonstrations at the end of the calendar year last year, arriving around the 28th of December, when the currency collapsed in Iran. Well, things are absolutely no better. They're a hell of a lot worse, with a lot of fuel dumps being blown up, now attacks on threats to the water infrastructure, which is a war crime prima facie, as your old friend and my friend Jeremy Bowen has been pointing out consistently. Mm. You know, it is completely... It sounds as if we've not got a war plan, but somebody just lashing out in desperation.
Well, blind fury as opposed to epic fury, you know.
Yeah. And I think that where we can see whatever the insults to Europe, yes, they're important, and Europe is going to have to do something. And I think Europe will do something. But the more important thing is the effect on the Gulf allies of America. They're feeling as if they're really caught in this. Mm. And I don't think they're going to be so sympathetic to the wiles of the likes of Witkoff, Jared Kushner, and Trump himself, probably for this presidency. I think that that's where this is a seminal turning point. I think it's far more serious than the Suez Crisis of 1956 was for Britain and the decline of the British Empire. I think it's certainly looking like the big event for Western alliance and Western cohesion since 1945.
Well, on that note, Robert Fox, defense editor of the Evening Standard, really good to talk to you and have a wonderful Easter weekend. I'll chat to you again. Coming up after the news, this was not just impacting those in Iran, as those in Lebanon, especially Beirut, are having to evacuate their homes. 600,000 people have been given an evacuation order by the Israelis from southern Lebanon and told that they will not be able to return those homes. A lot of those villages will be destroyed because Israel, of course, is trying to uproot Hezbollah once and for all. Hezbollah firing rockets into northern Israel, yes, but also Israel once again not learning the lessons of his own history and prepared to invade and occupy parts of Lebanon. How is that going to go? We'll discuss that after the break. But coming up now here on LBC at 10:32, the LBC headlines with Dominic Ellis.
Marks and Spencer has urged the Home Office to do more to tackle high street crime. Bosses are warning that shoplifting and attacks on staff are becoming more aggressive and brazen. President Trump has said there's much more to come after the US bombed Iran's largest bridge. Iranian state media say 8 people were killed. And NASA's Artemis 2 mission has left Earth's orbit and is now heading for the moon. The 4 astronauts fired their spacecraft's engine overnight to the next stage of their journey. LBC weather, windy with scattered showers for many areas, sunny spells and showers in the north and in the east, a high of 16 degrees.
This is LBC.
Sandy!
Where's London calling?
Yep, off on a bike tour. Got 2-for-1 with SWR rewards.
Ooh, I'm seeing that immersive exhibition everyone's chirping about.
Great taste! One might say impeccable.
Make every trip a treat with SWR rewards and get hundreds of deals on shows, meals and more. With fares frozen until 2027, there's no better time to travel. Southwestern Railway. Spread your wings. T's and C's apply.
So, you're geared up for this Making Tax Digital thing?
Sure, I just need some new mud boards, bag of cavity tyres and a couple of lintels.
Hey, MTD, mate, digital taxes.
Mm-hmm, it's an extension down Station Road on the corner.
Dave, digital taxes, mate.
Yeah, probably will need some 2x4s. I want to go take the van in for a new fan belt, squeaky.
Hey, Making Tax Digital, Dave.
Avoiding MTD. Sage makes tax simpler for sole traders. Search Sage MTD to get your free software today.
Tesco Insurance are driving down the cost of motoring with 10% off car insurance. Take out a car insurance policy before the 15th of May 2026 and you'll get 10% off with club card prices. We offer a range of cover options so you can choose the one that's right for you. Save 10% when you buy or renew a car policy with Tesco Insurance. Search Tesco Car Insurance and get a quote direct today. Club card required. Excludes add-ons. T's and C's apply.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
This is LBC. Message Matt Fry on WhatsApp now. 0345 60 60973.
Of course, there's not just one war going on in the Middle East, the war between Israel, America and Iran. There's also the Lebanon war. Now, this is something that the Israelis picked up on almost as soon as the bombing started on February the 28th in, you know, sympathy, you know, in coordination with the regime in Tehran. Hezbollah, of course, backed by Iran, very pro-Iranian, was its really most powerful proxy in the region, more than the Houthis, more than Hamas, decided to, you could argue, more than President Assad of Syria, who, of course, is also long gone now. They decided to fire rockets into northern Israel. That gave the Israelis an excuse to launch a full-scale attack on southern Lebanon, but also on Beirut, the suburbs where Hezbollah is entrenched. And Hezbollah is not, you know, we prescribe them as a terrorist organization, but they're more than that. They run bits of Lebanon. Not everyone in Lebanon is happy about that, to put it very mildly, but they are, you know, they run schools and kindergartens. You know, they are embedded in Lebanese society and have been for years. And if I'm not mistaken, that whole situation was partly fueled by Israel's last invasion of Lebanon in the early 1980s. So everything in this part of the world, every action has a reaction, and it is littered with unintended consequences. But let's get a sense of what's going on in this Lebanon war, the other war, because it is incredibly dramatic, especially for such a small country, even though one that's been used to so many terrible things over the decades. Let's call to Karim Chahayeb. He's the Middle East reporter for the Associated Press and joins us from Beirut. Good morning, Karim.
Good morning.
It's good to speak to you. Just give us an update of how it is today. Did you have a busy night? Were there more bombings in Beirut? What's the situation like in southern Lebanon?
So there certainly wasn't bombings in Beirut overnight, but it has been a very, very dramatic and intense week. There, a couple of nights ago, there were some overnight bombings in areas very close to the center that came without warning, including some busy neighborhoods, but that was well overnight. Southern Lebanon, the Israeli ground forces continue to push in this ongoing invasion. There has been fierce fighting in areas, but it seems like they have continued to gain ground. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz has, you know, has said several times that the intention is to create what he calls a security zone using the Litani River as sort of a de facto border. And over a million people have been displaced, largely from southern Lebanon, cannot return indefinitely or until further notice. And obviously this raises fears of a new occupation of southern Lebanon, because these are the similar boundaries of that back when Israel controlled and occupied southern Lebanon from 1982 till 2000. And meanwhile, of course, there's a lot of tensions because, you know, 1 million people displaced in a month in a country of just over 5 million brings a lot of tensions, especially in a country, as you mentioned earlier, where there, you know, the opinions of Hezbollah and, you know, political divisions are very, very tense. So it's, and, you know, and whether or not there are strikes in Beirut, you hear Israeli jets rumbling in the sky. There are strikes in the southern suburbs almost daily. And of course, the Israeli drones hover over everyone's heads, not knowing what's going to happen next. So there's a lot of tension in Lebanon, even on days where strikes in central Beirut aren't taking place.
Okay, and we talk a lot about the Litani River, which is that river that kind of slices through the southern bit of Lebanon. If all that area south of the Litani River is effectively, is controlled by Israel, possibly occupied by Israel, becomes de facto part of Israel, a bit like the Golan Heights, which used to be part of Syria, what chunk of the country is that? I mean, how much is that? Like a fifth of Lebanon or less than that? Give us some idea of the geographical space.
It would be, I believe the estimate is around 10 or a little over 10% of Lebanon. Right. We have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that live there. If they control every part of Lebanon, south of Litani, you're talking about major cities, including the coastal city of Tyre, for example. And of course, a complete displacement of many Shiite Muslims, but also Christians who live in villages down there. So it would be a major demographic shift, which Lebanon doesn't enjoy very much because of its very tense sectarian politics.
Okay, and talking about this tense sectarian politics, I mean, I have yet to meet a non-Shia Lebanese who likes Hezbollah. And, you know, they are, it's been described by many Lebanese politicians who are not Shia Muslims as a cancer inside Lebanon that has kind of held the country in a stranglehold for so many years. So what is the attitude of ordinary Lebanese, whether they're Christians or Sunnis, you know, against you know, what the Israelis are doing at the moment? Are they saying this is a necessary action to uproot and finally weaken and destroy Hezbollah? Or is it destroying much more than that?
I think people that are sympathetic to, from my conversations and my reporting in Lebanon over the years, that there's not a lot of people who are necessarily cheering on the strikes in Lebanon or who are sort of enjoying the misery that the Shiite community is going for. But a large segment is extremely frustrated, if not furious, with Hezbollah for taking that unilateral decision on firing the rockets, because Lebanon just came out of a war in May 2024, which, you know, battered large swaths of the country, $11 billion in damages. And while granted the ceasefire was not being fully implemented with daily Israeli strikes in the south and so on, Lebanon sort of was in a phase where they were trying to fix their relationship with the Gulf, get their economy back in order. They just felt that This was not the time for us to be dragged into another war, especially, you know, given that they were hoping that there would be some sort of recalibration of the state, a better period of stability. It's, you know, as you said, Lebanon goes through wars very frequently. It has a very troubled history. So there's that sort of fury on that. And there are segments, of course, outside of the Shia community that are sympathetic to Hezbollah, given the scale of the Israeli attacks and the displacement and the Lebanese army's inability to really defend the country, given its capabilities. But, you know, the fury against Hezbollah and their ability to make such decisions and the fact they have their own armed presence outside of the state, people are no longer as quiet about it as before. And the tensions are quite apparent, both in political spaces and on the ground as well among ordinary people. That's for sure.
And tell me, I mean, you know, the Houthis, which are, of course, also pro-Iranian, they sat on the sidelines for the first 3 weeks of this war. They finally got involved, although, you know, in a fairly piecemeal way. I mean, I think three or four rockets, missiles fired against Israel. Why do you think Hezbollah, which has seen its leader Hassan Nasrallah killed a few years ago by the Israelis, which has seen other senior leaders either killed or injured, you know, or humiliated by the Israeli pager attacks, you know, they've been severely depleted. Why would they be so suicidal as to engage in this war at a very moment when they could have just sat on the sidelines? And then if the Israelis had used the war anyway as an opportunity to get them, they could have at least owned a little bit of the moral high ground.
That is the million-dollar question. I mean, in the last war, you know, the so-called 12-day war back in June, Hezbollah sat out as well. And this sort of gave a bit of a, you know, bit of respite for some of the Lebanese. They thought, you know, maybe things are changing, right? And at this point, a lot of Lebanese officials early on in the regional war, the Iran war, were saying, you know, we're telling Hezbollah to stay away from it. And it seems there are political officials, allies of Hezbollah, who got guarantees, reportedly. And it definitely came by surprise, even to a lot of their own constituents and supporters, based on the conversations that I had. Now, the official narrative from Hezbollah leader Sheikh Naim Asim was that, you know, we've been dealing with Israel's constant bombing since the ceasefire deal. Israel hasn't withdrawn from five hilltops in the south, and we found it to be the appropriate time to intervene. But this is a narrative that a lot of people aren't necessarily buying in the country, especially, of course, their opponents. While a lot of people understand that Israel has been bombing the country since the ceasefire, the timing, which happened not long after the killing of Ayatollah Khamenei, sort of indicates that Hezbollah entered this war for Iran. That's a popular opinion. Now, I think what's happening at the moment, what we're witnessing, is that even though Israel is pushing in, there is a narrative from Hezbollah supporters, their members of parliament and so on, about the sort of war of attrition, about staying on the land. And it does sound like that they are trying to say that this, and I mean, they've said this, that this is an existential war. They've said this in Arabic, literally. It's an existential war for the Shia community. And so it is a war of attrition approach, it seems. And I think their presence is the measuring stick of whether they're successful or not, which of course is very detrimental given the scale of the damage. But this is the approach that they're taking at the moment.
Okay, just one final one. I mean, there is a Lebanese connection in the Trump family, and as we know, with Trump, family matters enormously. Massa Boulos is a Nigerian-Lebanese car tycoon. He's got a big factories in Nigeria, but he's by birth he's Lebanese, I think. His son Michael is married to Tiffany Trump, Trump's daughter. Does that have any kind of significance? Is that being played out in any kind of way that might help the Lebanese or not?
Speaking of Massoud Boulos, I mean, when the last war ended, and that was under the Biden administration with Amos Hochstein being the mediator, there was lots of reporting that Boulos was going to be the next U.S. envoy to, you know, follow up on the ceasefire and handle the issue in Lebanon. And then it turned out that he sort of moved towards more affairs in Africa. And Lebanon at the time was dealing with Morgan Ortega's as well as Tom Barak, Tom Barak being the ambassador in Turkey to the U.S. and the special envoy to Syria. But now it appears that there is no really designated U.S. envoy. The U.S. ambassador to Lebanon at the moment, Michel Issa, who is also of Lebanese origin and in fact speaks in Arabic to the media from time to time, seems to be the mediator. But at the moment, there is no strong U.S.-led initiative. The French have tried, President Emmanuel Macron, as well as the Lebanese president, have tried to lead something. But there is no diplomatic offer at the moment. Mm. And there is no indication yet if the Americans are going to push for a diplomatic initiative like they have in the past.
Fascinating. Karim Chahayeb, it's great to speak to you. Hope we can do that again sometime. He is the Middle East reporter of the Associated Press based in Beirut. Coming up next, the IDF Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir, again warned lawmakers on Wednesday in Israel that the military would face severe harm if the government doesn't pass legislation addressing the army's personnel shortages. I'll be speaking with a former member of the Israeli parliament about this and how this war is going down inside Israel, where I've just been for the last 2 weeks. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is now 10:46.
This is LBC.
At Lidl, get everyone around the table this Easter with fresh veg from only 4p each. With cracking prices on British Swedes, parsnips, 1 kilogram of carrots and 2 kilograms of potatoes for 8p. And more. That's sure to put a spring in your step. Lidl. More to value.
Subject to availability. Selected stores GB only. Simone combined her old pensions with PensionBee. So I had multiple pensions from various jobs that I have been in, and every 6 months or so I would receive a statement, and I was losing track of all my different pensions and all the different statements. I just wanted one easy way of keeping them all in one place.
At Pension B, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionb.com and be pension confident. When investing, your capital is at risk.
Right, who's all in for Cancer Research UK's Race for Life? Sunday Leaguers, dog lovers, bait clubbers, banger dancers, baby ravers, potters. Whether you walk it, jog it, or run it, go all in against cancer. All in to help fund life-saving research. Sign up now and save 50% off entry to your local 3K, 5K, 10K or Pretty Muddy event. Search Race for Life. Discount ends April 19th, 2026. T's and C's apply.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato.
Whoa!
And spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah!
Do you ever feel like getting back under your duvet in the middle of the day? Ferroglobin is a great-tasting liquid formula with iron, which contributes to the reduction of tiredness and fatigue and normal formation of haemoglobin. Ferroglobin from Vitabiotics at Boots, pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com.
Matt Fry on LBC.
So I've just been in Israel for 2 weeks. I came back a few days ago, and I've spent a lot of time in Israel since October the 7th. I used to live there a long time ago in 1989 during the first Intifada, which seems like a distant planet by now. But what struck me this time was just the number of signals of alarms that go off all the time, whether in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. And yes, the Iron Dome and David's Arrow and all the other interceptor kind of systems that the Israelis have developed shoot 95% of the stuff out of the sky. But things do land, and they can cause damage, and they can kill people, and they can injure, and they destroy neighborhoods. So in Israel, you feel the war as well. Probably not as much as you do in Tehran, certainly not nearly as much as you did in Gaza, let's be honest. But you do feel the war, and this has been going on for a long time now, with a brief intermission last year. So I just wonder whether Israel is ready for forever war. And we just heard the head of the IDF has said he needs more soldiers in order to fight in southern Lebanon or get ready for whatever else might be coming their way. So what's the mindset? What's the plan? What's the idea? Let's speak to Dr. Einat Wolf. She's chair of the Oz Party. Good morning, Einat.
Good morning.
It's good to speak to you. So I don't know, what does the Israeli public feel about this war? Because the impression I got on the streets of Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or wherever else we went was that there was a broad understanding that Iran is an implacable enemy. Iran doesn't even call Israel by its name. It calls it the Zionist entity. Iran has declared over and over again it wants to destroy Israel. So they get the reasons for this, but they're not entirely sure about the methods. And I think they're getting tired of spending too much time in a bunker. What do you think?
Generally, I think this is a correct description, but I would still argue that by and large, there is an understanding that things cannot be as they were, and that there was a unique opportunity, which I think all Israelis continue to hope for and are even willing, I would say, to sacrifice for, that the people of Iran will rise up to take their country.
Yeah.
Because unlike in other situations or with other enemies, here we see a very clear distinction between a substantial share, could be even the majority of the people of Iran, and their government. And that there is an actual desire to see change. You know, there used to be a joke that if you want to create really dedicated capitalists, you want to make sure that they live under the Soviet Union. And in the same way, we know that many people in Iran, there's actually data that 2/3 of Iranians do not identify as religious.
Sure.
So in many ways, once the regime falls, Iran is more likely than any country in the Middle East to be pro-Western, genuinely pro-Western, even secular, and I would say democratic. So for that vision, even though it sounds really far off, I think not. But for that vision, Israelis are willing to sacrifice and suffer. Just for something that is halfway, I agree with you. For that, there's more a question mark.
I think that's really fascinating. I mean, certainly the impression I have from my Iranian friends, and most of them live outside Iran, a few are still in there, although, you know, I've not been able to contact them in the last few weeks. But they make the point that you make. You know, we're not fundamentalist Islamist. We have a long and very long and very proud history, a Persian history. And we are, you know, we were, even under the Shah, we were more democratic than we are now. We were very pro-Western. We have a high level of education, all that stuff. I get all that. But the trouble is that, you know, wars have a habit of making small groups of very determined people who are fighting for their existence. And it is an existential war for the Iranian regime, whatever is left of it. They have a habit of making them stronger. So in the real world, even though we'd all love to see Iran turn into Sweden or Denmark, albeit somewhat larger, and potentially a lot richer, we'd all love to see that. But in the actual world, what's happened is the regime has been rebooted for now. And that is a worrying thing, is it not? Especially for Israel.
So I would actually question that as a general rule, because I don't know that World War II did much to consolidate the Nazi regime or
But it involved a full-scale land invasion after 4 years of World War involving the Americans, the Brits, you know, to some extent the French, you know, and the Soviet Union. I mean, it was a massive, massive operation that cost millions of lives.
And true, because that wars were different then. I mean, we are now in different technology, different scales. Also here, Iran, despite everything, remains actually quite isolated. The regime remains quite isolated. I think, again, if you look at the difference between the U.S. and Iran, it is still incredibly, incredibly asymmetrical. So you're absolutely correct that the Iranian regime understands that it is an existential war and that it's not something that they can actually survive. And by the way, this is where I see hope, which sounds odd, because the more the regime kind of makes it clear that this is existential, they're not willing to compromise. If you notice, in many ways, what the Americans are offering the Iranians is a kind of Japan-Germany situation. And that's why he's also saying, I don't see why they won't take it. He's basically telling them, there will be no sanctions. You will be an open country. We will invest in you. You will be part of the world. You just have to stop being insane, fanatical people who want to export an Islamic revolution. Now, the thing
is,
this
is all wishful thinking, isn't it? I mean, while you still got the Ayatollahs in charge, and they're still able to, through the besieged militia, to kill people on the street who protest against them, they are in a position of power to exert their will, which maybe only represents 20% of the Iranian population, onto the other 80%. And unless you go in there and you have genuine regime change, which is what we don't have at the moment, we've got a Nepo Ayatollah Khamenei in charge of the country nominally after his father. That's not regime change. So I just wonder, you know, for Israel, you're looking at potentially a forever war against these people unless they're removed by their own crowd at some stage in the future. And that's probably as much wishful thinking now as it was a year ago.
I don't think so. I don't think it's wishful thinking. First of all, we've already moved, ironically, from the Ayatollah regime to the Revolutionary Guards. They're already, you know, in a defensive mode. I know that it's easy to kind of look at their current survival and to extrapolate from that and to forget all the fundamentals. We know that their economy is weak. We know that already they are probably the majority of people are against them. They are facing the most powerful country in the world. We seem to kind of lose sight of the fundamentals and extrapolate from the fact that they're, you know, 33 days into the war and they're still standing. But they are, every day they are weakened. And ultimately, we know that it wasn't just this last time that the people rose up. We know that for years now, the kind of the rising, the uprisings become more and more, and they're not kind of disappearing. The regime is not gaining more legitimacy with its people. What you hear, I hear too. When people are able to get their messages out, is the message is, please don't stop. We will rise up as soon as we kind of know that the moment of the war is over. So I don't think it's wishful thinking. I think all the elements are there.
Right, but I'm not, I've seen so many, I've covered so many Iranian uprisings, many from outside Iran, where people thought this is the moment and then it wasn't. Maybe this is different. But just one more, Einat. I mean, you know, Israel bombed Gaza to smithereens, destroying 80%, I think, of buildings, killing over 70,000 people, most of them civilians. It was all about obliterating Hamas. Hamas still nominally runs much of Gaza. It has not disarmed. It is still in charge, albeit of a pile of rubble. So it didn't even work in Gaza. How do you think it's going to work in Iran? Briefly.
But this is exactly where the difference is. Unfortunately, and this I said from the beginning, Hamas is not separate from the people in Gaza, and unfortunately not separate from all of those who identify as Palestinians. Hamas is very much the executor of an ideology that I've come to call Palestinianism, to which unfortunately there are almost no exceptions. It unites the Arabs of Gaza and the West Bank and millions in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan in the unique obsession that it's more important to destroy the Jewish state than to build for themselves.
I know what you're saying. I hear this a lot from Israelis. I spent quite a bit of time in Gaza, and I was there for the last war, not the one that's just ended, but the one in 2022. And I cannot tell you the number of people I spoke to. They were all afraid of Hamas, but they would whisper into my ear saying, please help us get rid of these people. You know, they're vicious, they're running a police state, and I'm afraid to say so in public. That's not collusion. That's just the kind of fear that brutal regimes exert on, you know, on their citizens.
I would still beg to differ here, because there are people in the West Bank, there are people live in Columbia University, and all over, you do not see exceptions. Even when they are not happy with Hamas as an organization, I'm sure you remember the euphoria on October 7th, when they thought Hamas was succeeding, was across the board, because they realized that Hamas was executing their vision for the destruction.
But again, we don't know that, do we? Because we weren't in there, we weren't allowed to be in there. So the thing is, it's very difficult to get a nuanced picture.
No, we saw that across social media. You did not see a single person across the world of those who identify as Palestinians walk with a sign, not in my name. You can actually very clearly see it, that this is a unifying ideology, and this is the precise difference from Iran. We should be so careful in just saying, oh, this, and this is the same.
No, I'm not saying it's the same. I'm just saying that despite everything that Israel has done, Hamas is still nominally in charge, and that was never the plan.
Because I agree. Yeah. The goal, and this I said from the beginning, the goal with Palestinianism should have been, like with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, to bring down the ideology. As soon as we focused only on the executive arm, I said from the beginning, it was bound for failure.
Yeah, but you've got to hold out the branch of hope as well. I mean, you know, there was a thing called the Marshall Plan, and the Allies were very, you know, deliberate in defeating the Nazis, but they almost immediately started to build up what was left of Germany in order to create a democratic, viable, functioning, prosperous state. That was the plan. I don't see that plan for Hamas, but we can carry on. Now, we've already massively, you know, burst into the news break, and that's the wonderful thing about arguing with Israelis, is that they always argue back and you end up with a very long conversation. So I apologize. Here on LBC with Dr. Einar Wolf, thank you very much. I hope to speak to you again. But here on LBC, it is now 11:02, which means it is time for the news headlines with Dominic Ellis.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, executives at Marks & Spencer are urging the government to do more to tackle a rise in retail theft and violence. Bosses are warning that shoplifting and attacks on staff are becoming more aggressive and brazen. It follows incidents of so-called link-ups, where groups of young people arrange to meet using social media before surging into shops. Vicky Shotbolt is from the group Parent Zone and has spoken to LBC.
This isn't a new phenomena for sure, but social media has thrown fuel on it. And I think what parents really can do is talk to their young people about the consequences of getting involved in this kind of activity, because there are consequences. And the police have made that very, very clear. So I think we have to accept that teenagers will break the rules. But in today's world, they really do need to understand that taking part in this kind of activity will have consequences, and there'll be legal consequences they'll have to live with for a long, long time.
The Home Office says it is giving police stronger powers. President Trump has said there's much more to come after the US bombed Iran's largest bridge. Iranian state media say 8 people were killed. Earlier this week, President Trump suggested that US forces could end the conflict in the Middle East within 2 to 3 weeks. Defense editor of the Evening Standard, Robert Fox, has told Matt Fry it remains to be seen if any of the US's objectives will be met.
He wanted a quick excursion, as you say. He outlined all these things. If you remember, the 28th of February, he said, rise up, people of Iran, regime change, we're here to help, and we'll get rid of all those strategic and tactical missiles and drones and the nuclear threat. Well, not one of those 4 or 5 has been fulfilled completely.
A man's been arrested after a 27-year-old woman was found dead at a property in Lincolnshire. Police were called to Horncastle on Thursday afternoon. A 34-year-old man was detained by officers and is being questioned on suspicion of murder. The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, is reportedly looking to approve the first major North Sea oil and gas field project in almost 10 years. Ministers are under pressure to look at options following energy security concerns triggered by the war in Iran. The Labour government previously banned new licences for new oil and gas fields in the North Sea. And NASA's Artemis 2 mission has left Earth's orbit and is now heading for the moon. The 4 astronauts fired their spacecraft's engine for the next stage of the journey overnight. They've described the views as spectacular. LBC weather, windy with scattered showers for many areas through Good Friday. Some sunny spells and showers for the north and in eastern areas, with a high today of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
British Gas have this thing. We call it home care. We'll fix all sorts, and it's unlimited repairs. Expert engineers will solve the upset of boilers not boiling or taps that won't wet. Electrics playing tricks or a pipe that's broke. We're there for everyone, even blue furry folk. Your home won't feel booby-trapped. It'll feel just like new. British Gas, taking care of things and looking after you. T's and C's apply. Excess options available per repair.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Matt Fry.
So I want to spend this hour talking about what the war in Iran is doing to us over here on this side of the pond. It kind of feels as if Uncle Sam is channeling Dirty Harry. And I'm not sure if we're very comfortable with that. Long gone are the times when the UK could rely on its trusted old friend on the other side of the Atlantic. With Donald Trump running rampage, not just across town, but across the world, is he driving Sir Keir Starmer back into the arms of the European Union? Do we want to be back in the arms of the European Union? It feels very lonely at the moment to be without a gang. So what do we do about it? I mean, it was quite interesting. The day that France, Spain and Italy all closed their airspace to American bombers flying to Iran on bombing missions was the day that Buckingham Palace finally confirmed that the king was heading to Washington for the 250th anniversary of the birth of the American Republic. There's so many ironies in all that. But let's examine what this is doing to us and how do we respond. I mean, it's also remarkable. The Prime Minister gave a very strong speech, I thought, the other day when he said very clearly, this is not our war. This is not in our national interest. And yet we are having to make some difficult choices here, aren't we? Let's speak to Lord Peter Ricketts, former Permanent Secretary to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, UK National Security Advisor under David Cameron and British Ambassador to France, and also to Karen Ross, former British diplomat who covered the Middle East at the UN and is now a diplomatic advisor and writer. Good morning to both of you and happy Easter. First to you, Peter. Given our position at the moment, how does this compare to previous awkward moments in our relationship between us and the United States? Put this into a context.
Well, good morning, Matt. As long as I can remember, which is now quite a long time in British foreign policy, we have always tried to avoid choosing between America and Europe. Right back to Suez, if you remember the Suez crisis, Britain came out of that saying we must never be separated from the Americans again. The French came out of it saying we must never be dependent on the Americans again. And that's how it's played out over the last 60 years or so. There have, of course, been times of real stress and tension. I worked for Geoffrey Howe in 1983 in his private office when Reagan sent the Marines up the beaches of Grenada, which was a dependent territory of the UK in the Commonwealth. And they, without consulting Thatcher, knocked over the government and put the Governor General on a American warship. And Thatcher was furious, but she chose not to show the fury in public because of the deep-seated sense that we were closest allies to America. We did depend heavily on them in defence and intelligence in other areas. And so we kept our anger private and tried to manage the relationship. That is now under more stress and strain than I've ever known it. And the way Trump has behaved, first over Greenland, now over Iran, and the insulting of Starmer and other European heads of government, really has knocked the stuffing out of NATO, which is an organization that is built on trust rather than treaties. And so we are in a new world where long-held British assumptions are having to be very, very rapidly reconsidered.
So to be clear, although Vietnam was a crisis because we didn't send troops, the Americans were upset about it. Grenada was a crisis because they basically invaded a British territory, as it were. This is different because there's so much more at stake. There's the NATO alliance. We have a war in Europe with Russia and Ukraine. But also the language. I mean, the language coming out of the White House, coming out of the Department of War, as it now likes to be called, that's something we've never heard before. And they might have been, shouting each other in private, but not like this in public.
Yes, because the shouting at each other took place in a wider context. First of all, the Cold War, when we had absolutely crucial interests in common with the US. And then in the post-Cold War period, where we found that, we still had major overlapping interests, although the shift in American policy and priority away from Europe towards Asia and China as a confrontation, I mean, that's been underway since at least Obama. But yes, it was always in a wider context where there was an essential understanding and confidence between the allies. I mean, to have an American talking about bombing Iran back to the Stone Age, to having these insults, but also to having what's going on in the war. I mean, there's a letter we've seen in the media today from 100 academics, jurists, mostly American, expressing real concern about the likelihood that there have been war crimes in what's been done in Iran. So that is a very, very different context. And therefore, of course, Starmer is having to turn towards the Europeans, the other middle-sized powers like Canada, Australia, where we share a wide range of interests. We have a very much similar approach to this war. Britain is, of course, even more dependent on the Americans than most others. And we have taken these decisions to be involved at least with defensive operations by American forces using UK bases, which puts more into this than any other European country. But essentially, I think the combination of Putin and Trump is turbocharging the need for Britain to get closer to the EU and wider European cooperation. And Starmer, having made a rather slow start on that when he was elected, is now suddenly in favour of moving much more quickly towards linking up with Europe. The issue then is Brussels ready to throw out the rule book and bring UK much closer in to cooperation, economic, security, defence areas than has been possible in the past.
Colin Ross, do you agree with Lord Peter Ricketts that Britain actually is now in a position where it never wants to be, where it is kind of having to choose between Europe and America?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think Peter's absolutely right about the state of the transatlantic relationship. That choice is now upon us. And moving towards Europe is, of course, an obvious answer to that. But Europe, the EU, does not yet provide a security relationship. It's not, by and large, a security organization. It's an economic organization, also political in many ways, but not a defense organization. It cannot replace NATO, nor can it in any way replace the military industrial dependence that the UK has on the US, whether it's essentially renting our nuclear missiles, our Trident missiles from the US, where we pay the Americans to maintain the missiles, not the warheads, or the something like the F-35 program, which is a central piece of Britain's defense strategy for decades to come, which is, it's a multinational program, but it's essentially American. And we are completely dependent on that. Replacing those dependencies with something else is going to take a long time. It can't really be accelerated. But politically, absolutely, Europe is the obvious destination for us. It's obviously got more political clout than we can muster on our own. It's a voice in the world that we can never be because of our size. It has clout to stand up to Trump on things like the tariffs, which we forget. We're still under Trump's tariffs, supposedly his great ally. He is punishing us economically every single day. So the choice is upon us. I don't think the British establishment want that choice. I think they hoped to be able to kind of do the splits across the growing chasm across the Atlantic. But I think the Iran war has made that balancing act more or less impossible.
And of course, there's always the threat from Donald Trump that he might want to leave NATO. And I know he's been thinking about it for quite a long time. I mean, even before the second administration. We know that, and he's been reiterating that threat in public in recent days, and other people have joined, including Marco Rubio, the normally more mild-mannered Secretary of State. If the Americans leave NATO, I mean, that would be a really serious crisis for us especially, wouldn't it? We would fall between lots of stools, wouldn't we? Can't.
Absolutely. NATO is a guarantee of our security, that all the members of NATO would come to our defence if we were attacked, as a principle that applies to all NATO members. And that guarantee hugely relies on American power, whether it's air power, naval power, a whole host of capabilities where the US hugely exceeds the capabilities of Europe. But it doesn't mean Europe does not have capabilities. You know, were there a Russian threat, for instance, the European countries could muster many hundreds of thousands of ground troops. And I think Europe has very much got the message that more or less, regardless of what Trump says day to day about his wishes for the US to stay in NATO or not, the US cannot be relied upon. And that trust has been broken forever. Even once Trump goes, we hope he goes, we cannot guarantee that there won't be another one in future. I think the assumption that America will come to Europe's defense is now over, and Europe has to draw the conclusions from that.
Lord Peter Ricketts, if we did want to get closer to the EU, and I mean, Starmer came up with a sort of vague idea of moving closer, but we know that there are lots of, I mean, there have been tons of procedural issues, even when it comes to youth mobility schemes and, you know, fairly minor clauses within this bigger picture. What would be the best way, Peter, for the EU and the UK to, you know, stitch up a closer relationship? And of course, there'd be misgivings on both sides.
Yes, there will. And Khan is absolutely right. Of course, NATO without America would not be NATO. It would be something else. And that's something else that Britain has got to concentrate on, a more European military cooperation. But yeah, Starmer started his government with what he called the reset. It was very hesitant. It was in a small number of economic areas. The negotiations to get us effectively back into the single market in those areas are still going on, will continue probably in 2027, but won't actually do more than very marginally change the economic outlook for the UK. On the security and defence side, again, we've got good cooperation going on, plenty of talking going on, but when we try to get access to the EU's defence investment instrument, they call it SAFE, for much bigger collective investment in defence industries, they rebuffed us by charging, proposing to charge several billion euros even to get in the door. So that shows that although the world is at war, we've got war in Europe, nevertheless, the protectionist instincts in the EU are still there and will take time to batten down. I think the honest answer is that nobody in the EU is going to make a big bet on the UK until they see a second election and the election of a pro-European parliament for a second time in Westminster, at which point I think they can begin to trust that we have durably shifted our attitude and it's time to do a big deal with this. And the big deal would frankly be to rejoin the single market.
Right.
Anything else is fiddling around at the edges and not delivering real economic benefit. But the Europeans won't embark on that discussion, I think, with the years now counting down towards the next election. I think it's a post-election issue. Between now and then, we've got to complete the rather transactional sectoral discussions we've got going on and try hard and get in a closer relationship on the defence industry, despite the protectionist instincts. Frankly, in France, where the French are always very keen to protect Dassault, not so much in the rest of the EU.
Right.
But even that shows how difficult this is.
Just in one word answer, are we more vulnerable now than we've ever been since World War II?
Not ever been, but
since World War II.
Since 1945, I think we are more vulnerable and more alone than we've been, yes.
Khan, what do you think?
I agree with Peter.
Okay. Peter, should the King go to Washington next month or not?
Well, it's a moot point, isn't it, Matt, because they've already announced he is going to go.
But
I think if the decision had been to take now, they wouldn't have decided to send him if that was a decision for now. I think they thought things had gone too far down the road. So he will go. He's an ultimate professional. I'm sure he will do his duty as he always does. The timing couldn't be more unfortunate.
Indeed. Lord Peter Ricketts, Khan Ross, thank you very much to both of you for coming on. And it's going to be time for you to talk to me after the break. There's so many calls now coming in. You've finally woken up from your Easter slumber. You've had that first premature Easter egg. You're on a sugar high. You want to talk to Matt Fry on LBC. Tons of callers coming in, and I promise you, we'll get to them as soon as this incy-wincy little break is over. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is now a glorious 11:20.
LBC. One of the best things about a holiday with Saga is your chauffeur, who'll pick you up and drive you to your departure point. Whether you're river cruising along the Rhine, past storybook castles, or uncovering centuries of history on a tour of Japan. Even better, they'll pick you up and drive you home again afterwards. 2026 season now on sale. Search Saga Holidays. Experience is everything. Nationwide chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply. Over 50s only.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex Business Card. Interest fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
Whether you're planning for your dream kitchen or that once-in-a-lifetime holiday, with the tax year ending soon, JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you make the most of your tax-free allowances. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing to learn more. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk. Tax rules vary by individual status and may change.
Why are you abseiling down the front of your house, Ross? You have a staircase.
I like doing things the hard way, Albert.
Try something easier, Ross. Get cheaper off-peak energy. It's available at different times, like during the day or weekends. Just get a smart meter and choose a flexible scheme or tariff.
Ooh, I could batch cook some quiche.
Perfect. With a smart meter, getting cheaper energy is easier than you think.
Eligibility varies. Action required. Schemes and tariffs available to selected customers. Only.
Matt Fry on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
The number is, of course, that one, 0345 6060973. You can also text me, you can shout at Alexa, but keep it clean. And we have got Karen on the line from Chippenham in Wiltshire. Karen, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hello, hello, Matt. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Happy Easter.
Thank you, and happy Easter to you. Well, we must, if Europe will have us, we must join a modernised and reformed European Union. And this is obviously not only for our economic and trade interests, which are important enough, but very importantly for our safety, security, including and especially defence and military security.
But the EU is an economic union, and the social union and the political union. It's not really got that much to do with defence.
Well, I think the way things are expanding and the way these days everything is controlled very much, by important sort of data requirements. Everything's data-driven now and digital. Mm. And we really do need data security, and we absolutely need to have our own European and UK data sovereignty. And that is, you know, for our cloud computing, but also for the control over our own data systems. And we don't want to be controlled by data analytics and relational databases run out of America, under the control of who knows what regime. And very importantly at the moment, you know, along with the defence and the military security, we really need to be thinking of all of our very important science and tech projects, our very key satellite technology, and as I said, I've already mentioned the data security. We should listen more to people like Professor Brian Cox, who every now and then, you know, he comes out and he really laments the way that we've been excluded from European science projects as a result of Brexit. Yeah. And only a couple of days ago, on Tuesday, in fact, on Jim Al-Khalili's programme, The Life Scientific, his really interesting guest, who was, who's worked for a long time on satellites, again, his guest reiterated, not to make a political point, but for how much we've lost, how difficult it is for us now in the UK to have all the, the involvement we need, you know, with all of this science and tech and satellite technology and data with Europe. And after all, you know, we should be under the European umbrella rather than, throw ourselves on the whims of somebody, of a country that might vote an erratic president like Donald Trump, who hasn't the faintest idea what he's doing and is causing a lot of damage to the world.
Well, he would, of course, beg to differ, Karen. He would beg to differ. I'm sure he's on the phone right now calling in saying that's not true, Karen. How can you say that? You're right, Karen. Although the point about the digital stuff and social media is that, you know, the biggest companies in the world that have created the greatest convenience for us through our smartphones or whatever, they're American. You know, we have not yet had a European Google or a European Apple. And there are lots of different reasons for that, and we don't have time to get into that. But it's convenience ultimately that drives us on that front into the American camp. And maybe that is about to end. Maybe they've overplayed their hand. And maybe Musk has a large part to play in that. Karen and Chippenham, thank you so much. Let's go straight to David and Bayswater. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Matt. I don't know if it's the first time I've spoken to you, but it's really good to talk to you. Yeah, so
talk to you as well, David.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. So basically, I think the confusion is in partly also in Britain's behaviour, because up until recently, they've been behaving like America's lapdog. They crept up to Trump, you know, the state visit and Starmer going to the White House and everything, saying all the right things to him. And basically, I think it made him feel he had carte blanche in Britain's eyes to do anything he would, and he would get their support. And remember, he did give them preferential tariffs as well. He's a businessman. He doesn't give things for free. And I think the Starmer's policy has now become betwixt and between. He put his foot in the camp of Trump, and now he's trying to pull it out. And it's totally ill thought out policy. Either you on one side or the other, you can't be in the middle. And I think we know his capriciousness, Trump. So this was totally predictable. So I think it's been a complete mess in Starmer's part. And he only has himself to blame because he wanted to creep up to get the good trade deal, but now he's paying the price. You know, if you mix with the devil, you know what happens.
Well, you put yourself into his position. I mean, we have a very close relationship with America, whether we like it or not. You know, especially when it comes to security and defense. I mean, I talked to a senior British general in a few days ago, and he said, we have complete control of our nuclear missiles when we fire them, not that we want to. We do in theory, but the shop that repairs them, that tweaks them, that provides them, is American. So, you know, without their maintenance, we can't really do an awful lot. So we are umbilically tied, and it's tricky for us to do that. But I also think a lot of it rests on the American view of what Britain is. And this obsession with Churchill, frankly, I think is rather misguided. Not that I'm saying he was a great man, but Churchill, you know, is not today's Britain. And for another time, David in Bayswater, thanks for your call. Let's go straight to Alex in Wrexham. Alex, you're now on the air.
Okay, good morning, Matt.
Good morning, how are you?
Not too bad.
You sound very chirpy, what's going on?
Well, it's Easter. Anyway, what I'd like to point out is, certainly from my own opinion, I prefer that the UK rejoins the single market.
Yeah.
We start to formulate somehow or other, and I'm not saying it's going to be easy, a European army. And if we have a European army, we've got no alternative but to join a common currency.
Right.
So you're
using defence as a way through the back door to get back in again?
I don't think it's a way to get back in. I think it's a part of the jigsaw. A part of the picture is, if we want our own security, we've got to be part of that single market, and we need a common European defence force. It's as simple as that. You can't separate one from the other.
Alex, I think you make complete sense. Alex in Wrexham. Let's go to Chia in Hayes. Have I pronounced your name? No, Ola. Is it Ola? What's your name? Hayes. Mr. Hayes. Hello?
Yes, Ola from Ola. Hayes.
I'm Ola. Where's that name from?
That name is an African name.
Okay, I'm sorry. I've never heard Ola. It's nice to hear from you, Ola. What's your opinion? You've got a minute.
Yes. My opinion is, we have to be very pragmatic and not get too emotional about these things and look at things from a very broader and forward-looking approach. We have to ask ourselves, who is going to be winning the A highways? And all of that has to be brought into context. If you look at last year, the amount of capex that the top of American technology companies were putting in, You have to look at things in an economic point of view. And come to think about it, you might not like Trump, but Trump has always warned Europe about our not balancing our energy mix, which has made now we are caught up in not having enough energy, or in the future not having enough energy from the UAE. And about our defense spending, we can bang our heads around all the time and say, yeah, Trump, we don't like him. But we're not even taking much action. We're not increasing defense spending. Our defense budget is hollowed out. And
the government has announced an increase, but many people would argue it's too little, too slow.
Yes, so those are the steps we need to take to show the Americans that we have our skin in the game. We can talk, we can shout all. And when we say we're joining the EU, I'm for balancing a little bit, not to the extreme of not playing a part in the EU. We're going to be killing ourselves with regulations. And it's an economy that is barely budging or barely growing like us.
Indeed, but actually the other thing, you're right. I think there is too much regulation there. There's too much red tape, and their growth figures aren't exactly amazing either. And also don't forget the fact that the EU that we may fantasize about rejoining now might be very different by the time we get to it. I mean, if the AfD win in Germany, Marine Le Pen or her party win in France, you've got Giorgia Meloni in Italy, maybe Orban will survive the elections in Hungary next weekend. I mean, this is a different kind of EU to the one that we left in 20 or decided to leave in 2016. Hola, hola, hola. Thank you very much for your call. You're listening to me, Matt Fry, on LBC. Coming up,
RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition and lift off. The crew of Artemis 2, now bound for the moon.
I love that. Can you feel the throbbing of that rocket? Not since 1972 has humankind gone to the moon, and Artemis 2 is on its way on a 10-day journey around the dark side of the moon, and then, of course, back again. They won't be landing on the moon. That'll be for the next mission when they set up a moon base. And then, of course, it's on to Mars with Elon Musk and all his many children. I'll be speaking more about our renewed desire for extraterrestrial exploration and beyond. After the break, I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is now 11:31, which is time for the news headlines with Dominic Ellis.
Iran has renewed its strikes on targets on Israel and the Gulf states, including on energy facilities. Officials in Kuwait say an Iranian missile has damaged a power plant, while a gas plant in Abu Dhabi has been forced to close due to a fire caused by an intercepted missile. Officials in the Ukrainian capital Kyiv say the country is under another rolling aerial daytime attack. The bombardment is the second time this week that Russia has followed an overnight strike with further heavy attacks. And Marks and Spencer is urging the government to do more to tackle a rise in retail theft and violence. It follows incidents of so-called link-ups, where groups of young people arrange to meet using social media before surging into shops. LBC weather, windy with scattered showers for many areas, sunny spells and showers in the north and in the east, a high of 16 degrees.
This is LBC.
One of the best things about a holiday with Saga is your chauffeur, who'll pick you up and drive you to your departure point. Whether you're river cruising along the Rhine, past storybook castles, or uncovering centuries of history on a tour of Japan. Even better, they'll pick you up and drive you home again afterwards. 2026 season now on sale. Search Saga Holidays. Experience is everything. Nationwide chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply. Over 50s only.
Whether you're seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. With the tax year ending soon, JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you make the most of your tax-free allowances. Start making more informed investment decisions today with no management fees for your first 6 months. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing to learn more. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk. Tax rules vary by individual status and may change. T's and C's, exclusions and other charges apply. New clients only. Minimum investment of £500 by 5th of May.
This Easter at M&S, you'll find a selection of the yummiest chocolate animals. There's Hiccup the Hippo with his darling chubby little legs. And Sunny the Sloth, beaming with his milk and white chocolate features. Toby the T-Rex, who's a bit green, bit scary, but charming at the same time. And Ralph the Cavapoo. I almost don't want to bite his scrumptious little nose right off, but I will. All of these cuties for just £7 each. This is not just food, this is M&S food. Selected stores.
It's here. Matalan's Big Easter event has landed. And right now, for a limited time only, you can get 20% off women's wear too. Discover standout spring styles for less in your nearest store or head online to matalan.co.uk. But hurry, this offer ends Monday. T's and C's apply. Exclude selected brands.
From the big transformations to the small home improvements, you can feel as proud as a peacock with Wix.
Supply. This is LBC with Matt Fry. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We love it when you call up and we love it when we have a conversation, but we also love it when you send texts and messages. So let me read out a few that have come in. Steve says, come on, Matt, he says. Leaving NATO would shrink US global power, not strengthen it. Intelligent Americans know that. But do they? I say. And then another Steve says, people need to understand favorable tariffs is not a trade deal. Britain doesn't have a real trade deal with America. Point taken. And Alex weighs in with, it's not a complicated equation. EU membership equals stronger economy. Stronger economy equals more money for defense and less reliance on the unstable United States. And there are many more, and hopefully I'll get enough time to read them out. Okay, so keep them coming. And there's calls on 0345-6060-973. Now, let's talk about something completely different. We're so sick and tired of planet Earth. It's time to go to outer space. So let's just listen to what some of the esteemed astronauts on Artemis 2 were saying just before takeoff.
Well, I just kept saying to them yesterday, like, I really like it up here. I wish I could have got here sooner. It's just such a tremendous place to be. The views are extraordinary. It's really fun to be floating around, and it just makes me feel like a little kid.
Well, the first thing I would say is trust us. You look amazing. You look beautiful. And from up here, you also look like one thing. You know, Homo sapiens is all of us, no matter where you're from or you know, what you look like. We're all one people.
And I'm the space plumber. I'm proud of, to call myself the space plumber. I like to say that it is probably the most important piece of equipment on board. So we were all breathing a sigh of relief when it turned out to be just fine. It was just an issue, I think, of sitting for a long time and needing a little time to warm up, a priming issue. But we did originally think that there could have been potentially something fouling up the motor. And luckily, we are all systems go.
All systems go just as well, because what the space plumber was talking about was the loo. The one loo on Artemis 2 wasn't working properly. And that, of course, is a very bad thing to happen, especially in zero gravity. The mind boggles. Okay, let's speak to Dr. Kevin Fong, doctor and broadcaster, who's worked with NASA's human spaceflight programs in Houston before and is the host of the podcast 16 Sunsets, the story of the space shuttle. Kevin, it's good to have you on the program. So, are you as excited as, actually, quite a few people seem to be around the world about this particular mission? Because you could say, hang on a minute, we went to the moon 50 years ago, something like that, maybe a little bit longer. You know, are we all back to the 1980s now? We've been frozen in time. What's going on?
You can't not be excited about this, can you? I mean, if you saw it, if you watched the launch the other day, if you looked at what they've been doing now, this is incredible stuff. This crew is going further and faster than any human has gone in more than half a century. And this mission is going amazingly to plan so far. I kind of don't want to jinx it. It's going so well. But I have been following it every step of the way and very impressed.
Apart from the loo, that was a problem at the beginning.
They fixed it. They fixed it. So it's all right. That could have been quite mission limiting.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the... So why is this so important? So just for those of us, you know, who haven't been following every aspect of the Artemis 2 mission, why is this one so important?
So since we left the moon, the last person walked on the moon in 1972, we have conducted all our human space exploration in low Earth orbit, which is impressive, on the space station, on shuttle, on Soyuz, on the Mir space station. But that's about 250 miles from the surface of the Earth. Where this crew is headed now is out towards the moon. That is 250,000 miles away. And to get there, you need to travel incredibly fast. Last night, they did the so-called TLI burn, the translunar injection burn, which commits them to the moon. And that takes them up briefly to about 24,000, 25,000 miles per hour.
Wow.
And this is the antecedent to missions that will hopefully see us put humans back on the moon in the next few years.
And when they put those humans back on the moon in the next few years, assuming, you know, there is that mission and there's money for it, the idea is to set up a base. Tell us about that base.
So when we went to the moon in the 70s, all of the landings were around the equator, really. If you think of the moon and how it would look if you drew an equator line on it, we dotted ourselves around there on the visible side. This time they're going for the polar region and the south polar region. Why? Because there are areas of there that are permanently in shade, permanently cold, and therefore probably have water ice in them. If you've got water ice, you've got resources, you can set up a base. And then out of that, you can start then unfolding massive packages of science and exploration. It's really a lot like Antarctica. Antarctica, we went in 1912, Scott and Amundsen famously. You don't go back. We didn't go back until 1956 when we had better vehicles, better technology. And after that, you get this explosion of science. That's what I'm hoping for on the moon.
And do we actually know that there's polar ice on the south pole of the moon?
We've got a very good idea because we've had satellite probes flying by, and they've been very clever at being able to look down and detect the reflections off what's in those cratered areas. And it looks like there probably is water there.
And that is absolutely essential for surviving there.
It means that you can live off the land in a funny way, because, you know, if you've got water, you've got hydrogen, you've got oxygen, and that means you've got fuel and you've got something you can drink if you treat it properly, etc. So, yeah.
Okay. And so the idea is to set up a base and then use that, you know, to go, you know, to the next one, which is Mars?
Well, in a way, and this debate has run at NASA for as long as I have had anything to do with them, is where do you go next? And some people said, well, if we go to the moon, we'll get stuck on the moon, so we should just go straight to Mars. But the moon
easier
is
said than million, done.
Easier said than done. The moon is 250,000 miles away. Mars, at its closest point, is probably 400 million miles, something like that.
Yeah.
So I think this is a good idea. This is a sensible way to evolve our exploration architectures. You can liken it to you know, the way that you first learned how to go camping. You know, you don't decide to go off and stick your tent on the sides of K2 or whatever. You go in your parents' back garden. So you work out what it is that you forgot to pack and what you need and how to do it. And if you get into trouble, you can come home relatively quickly. This is what the moon is going to be for us.
And of course, you know, it's not just governments that are planning this, but also big private enterprises. I mean, you've got a sort of face off between two of the richest people in the world, Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon, Elon Musk, owner of Tesla and many other things, and SpaceX, who all want to go to space and have been going to space, or their wives have been going to space. How important is this sort of combination of private enterprise and public money in order to make this happen?
So away from those specific examples, you know, people, it's interestingly, some people get a bit queasy about the public-private partnership in all sorts of walks of life, actually. But this is how it's always been. Exploration has always been this sort of partnership between private and public enterprise.
Including in the last moon missions, I mean, 50 years ago?
Well, even back then, you had private contractors.
Yeah.
NASA were coordinating the contract, you know, the contracts, and you know, the state does not make every aspect of the technology they take, and that's true of Antarctic Survey today. And Antarctic Survey gives you a good model, yeah. Right? So a British Antarctic Survey does not build its snow skis; it gets whatever manufacturer it is, does not build its own planes. So this probably is the sustainable architecture of the future. Whether or not Jeff Bezos and the Elon Musk companies are the answer to that on their own remains to be seen, but private public partnership is the way forwards.
And I wasn't judging it in a negative way. I was just wondering whether actually the sheer amount of private money that has been earmarked by some rich individuals for space travel, you know, is a driving force in making this dream come true.
Yeah, so interesting. I think it has catalyzed things. So when I was at NASA, probably at the start of the century, odd to say that now, but, you know, people were talking about the further involvement of private companies and particularly companies like SpaceX as they came along. And honestly, SpaceX has done things which I and many other people never thought that we'd see. You know, they have this very interesting and innovative flyback first stage. So it means that you can reuse the rockets in the Apollo era. Even now, especially now with SLS Space Launch System, we chuck it all away. You know, it's just one-time use gear. Reusing stuff in space changes the game. It has changed our access to low Earth orbit. So yeah, look, I think that stuff's good. I've noted though that Elon Musk has lowered his sights recently because I interviewed him once about 12 years ago. He said he was going to go to, he said, when I retire, you'll be able to sell all your stuff and come with me to Mars. That is not where he's going now. He said, not Mars. And so how much more lowering of those sites there is remains to be seen.
Maybe he's going to Saturn, you know, even further. Who knows? Just finally, I mean, you could argue, could you not, that on Earth, we Earthlings, you know, whether it's Russia, Ukraine or Iran, you know, we're kind of showing our worst side in many ways. And we're behaving quite disgracefully. Also, when it comes to custodianship of the planet, environmental protection, you know, we seem to be all over the shop. Do you think that by going to, you know, going extraterrestrial, it might kind of refocus our minds? It might give us another appreciation of our own planet, the way that that famous picture of the Earthrise that was taken by one of the astronauts, where, you know, you see the Earth coming up over the moon. It was a very powerful picture. And, you know, it sort of triggered the founding of the EPA in America, the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, do you think the same thing might happen again, or have we basically lost the plot here on Earth?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I've thought about the spooky parallels between now and the mission in 1968. So Apollo 8 is the first flight to do exactly what these guys are doing. And that happens in a very tumultuous time. You know, the United States, there are protests about the Vietnam War. Richard Nixon is in office or about to be in office. He's president-elect. And there have been political assassinations. And there was a lovely letter that came to the Apollo 8 crew as they went around the back of the moon on Christmas Eve. When they returned, they were deluged with messages of congratulations. And one of them simply said, "Thank you for saving 1968. We could really do with someone who could save 2026 right now."
That's such a good point to end on. Dr. Kevin Fong, an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much indeed, and hope to speak to you again. Coming up, President Donald Trump on Wednesday said he rejected a new request for a ceasefire from Iran's president, and in the same breath threatened to bomb the country back to the Stone Ages if Tehran does not allow ships to resume passing freely through the Strait of Hormuz. What does that mean for the rest of us? I'm Matt Fyde. This is LBC. The time is 11:46.
This is LBC.
Tony, what do you want to tell me? Good morning.
Scott has called from Glasgow. Hi, Scott.
Jane's in Camden first. Hi, Jane.
Households will benefit from £150 off of their energy bills with a price cap, giving households certainty on their bills until July.
Hear every side of the story.
It feels like far too much of a luxury now to heat your house. Dharma is going to have to get involved.
I'm at the petrol station and it's just cost me nearly £100 to fill up half.
I'm almost in my 40s and I haven't ever had a break in war. In any of these living costs.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. LBC, leading Britain's conversation.
Lidl, get everyone around the table this Easter with fresh veg from only 4p each. With cracking prices on British Swedes, parsnips, 1 kilogram of carrots and 2 kilograms of potatoes for 8p. And more. That's sure to put a spring in your step. Lidl, more to value. Subject to availability, selected stores, GB only.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
How about Specsave ears?
Not sure.
Do you get it? Specsave ears?
Yeah, but no.
Oh, okay. Specs, and we also do hearing two savers.
Think about it. Should have gone to Specs and we also do hearing two savers. Can't see it catching on.
Okay, so we're saying Specsavers do eyes and ears. Senses savers.
Technically true.
Yeah.
But actually terrible.
Oh.
At Specsavers, we're hearing experts too, and have been for over 20 years.
Oh, should we just stick to Specsavers then?
Yeah.
Book a free hearing check today.
Interactive Investor would like to say welcome and thank you. Welcome to all our new investors who joined us over the past few months. And thank you to a certain competitor that decided to change their fee structure and sent them all our way. Visit Interactive Investor to see what you could save with our low flat fee. Interactive Investor. I think, therefore I. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk.
Yep, I'm still dancing. And there's still time to get in tonight's EuroMillions draw. So turn up that dial.
The EuroMillions jackpot is £72 million.
Go on, play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Matt Fry on LBC.
Well, from the moon back to Earth here and the war in Iran. Now, of course, one of the really tricky things is trying to get any sort of opinion from inside Iran, any insight to what's happening, because the internet is down. It has been shut down by the government. It was shut down at the beginning of the year in order to limit the scope of the protests, the anti-government protests that were taking place. And so, you know, getting hold of someone inside is incredibly difficult. We've been trying to do it on Channel 4 News almost on a daily basis. And we do get people occasionally and they will record voice messages. And that's really, really important because you get a much broader range of opinion than you would otherwise. And you can test the proposition of whether, you know, this is working, you know, whether people who don't like the regime are ready to go back on the streets and protest, or whether the scope of the bombing has turned them actually against the idea of regime change because they hate America and Israel even more than they hate their own regime. I mean, these are all valid questions. It is very difficult to answer them. And we have an Iranian guest in mind, but we're trying to get through to her at the moment. It's very difficult to do so. So in the meantime, on 03456060973, do please call me. You will get on the air. And I just want to read you a couple of texts while we try her again. We would need to have a referendum to rejoin the EU, surely, says Robin in Bournemouth. That's democracy, not government control. I take it from that, Robin, that you want us to rejoin and that you would be confident, perhaps, that if there was another referendum, heaven forfend, the Remain side or the Return side would win it. I wonder. Here's Ivan Brown. He says, in Gansel, we need to remember that Farage said if we remained in the EU, we would be dragged into a European army and we should avoid this and vote Brexit, which we did. Thank you, Nigel. I'm sure that was meant slightly sarcastically. I mean, there is a problem, isn't there? We are sort of, we feel a bit like knobby nomates at the moment. We're between the EU and the Americans that have seemed to have veered off into a distant galaxy of fantasies. And we're not quite sure who to align ourselves with. And that is a problem. Here's another one from Evan in West Wales. To put a different slant on this, I think the UK, Canada, Europe, Australia and New Zealand pivot away from the US and its resources. The major tech companies will put increasing pressure on the Trump administration to dial down on the hostile and intimidating language and rebuild bridges with its allies. After all, for them and Trump, it's all about the profit margins. I wonder if that's the case. But let's try, and I think we managed to get through it to Iran. So let's go to Nega Mortazavi, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and host of the Iran podcast. Nega, are you there?
Yes. Thank you for having me. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Are you in Iran or where are you at the moment?
No, I'm in Doha, Qatar.
Oh, in Qatar. Okay, fine. Well, I'm glad you're there and I hope you're safe, because Doha hasn't been that safe either
Thank you.
The past. So I'm trying to understand...
As safe as it could be.
Exactly. I'm trying to understand what you think is going on inside Iran. Has the bombing by Israel and America turned more people against the regime or in favor of the regime?
Well, you know, it's difficult. I don't want to speak on behalf of any sort of polling that hasn't been done, but I speak to people on the ground. There's anecdotes, and we also see the sort of the presence on the ground, on social media, all of that. It's fair to say it's done none, but it's created more unity and more nationalism. Because I think, well, one thing is you have a chunk of people that are sort of the base of the government, of the system, their supporters. It's definitely made them more stronger, created a rally around the flag for them. And that base is growing. They have a presence on the street in the form of rallies, demonstrations. They came out for funerals when assassinations happen. So they're showing a force that's very visible publicly. But I would say the part of the population that is against the system or is very critical and has all kinds of political, economic, social grievances is also seeing that this is not a war on just the system and the government. This is very much a war on Iran and Iranians. When you have the U.S. president threatening war crimes and then doing it and then posting the video, as a person on the ground, that gives you, you know, pause and sort of a clarification that this is not a surgical war on just officials and senior leadership. This is very much a war on the entirety of the country.
I mean, just last night we saw the Americans bomb the biggest bridge in Iran, the suspension bridge, I think near Tehran, that had only just been completed. And basically it's now sliced in half and it's unusable. And 8 people were killed and dozens of people were injured. There was an attack on the Louis Pasteur Medical Research Institute, which has been there for like 100 years. I mean, this is one of the most important research institutes for medicine in the Middle East. Why on earth was that destroyed? I just wonder... I mean, surely these kind of targets are totally counterproductive, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I guess we have to ask the U.S. president, why, what, and when? Why did this war start? What is it? Is it even a war? Is it a military operation? Is it limited? Is it endless? And when? When is this going to end? Mm. And, you know, there was reporting from Axios suggesting that even some aides to the president within the administration are just completely surprised by the things the president says, the stuff he posts on Truth Social, because he improvises a lot and there's a very clear lack of planning. Was this regime change? It wasn't done. Was this obliterating missiles? They're still shooting missiles. In fact, they're shooting better and more accurate ones. Is it the drones? That hasn't finished. Is it their capacity to fight back? It hasn't. And now they have a chokehold on the Strait of Hormuz on 20% of global energy. That wasn't even an issue a month ago. The war started and created this problem for the global community. And I think that's one of the reasons almost nobody wants a part in this war, even though President Trump is threatening everyone publicly, privately, including your own government, to join in and help, etc. But nobody wants, because this is, well, first of all, it's unclear what this is. It's unlawful according to the U.S. law. There was no vote from U.S. Congress. It's unlawful according to the international community. No Security Council, no consultation with allies. And it's also going very much for civilians and infrastructure, like you said. the institute, medical centers, schools, hospitals, water desalination, oil, gas. And now the president is actually threatening and then making good on his threats and then boasting about it with videos and photos saying he's going to turn around back to the Stone Ages. I mean, all of this is completely unprecedented for the president of the United States.
So if you're an opponent of the regime, if you're one of the relatives of the people who were demonstrating at the beginning of the year who might have been killed or injured, if you really want to see the back of this Islamist, you know, ideological, you know, hardened group of men that have been running your country, you know, since 1979, you are not thanking the U.S. president right now.
Well, absolutely not. And this is if you're alive, you know, you and your entire family is alive. If your house hasn't been bombed, if you haven't been collateral next to a building that was bombed for reasons you probably don't know, that's one thing. And then also change doesn't come, you know, freedom doesn't come with bombs. Did it come in Afghanistan? No. The keys were handed back to the Taliban and the U.S. left. Did it come in Iraq? No. It just created more instability, terrorism, and all kinds of insecurity for the entirety of the region, in Syria, in Libya. So yeah. This has been tried again and again, and it's failed. And that's why, actually, I want to point out the irony is that this U.S. president, he very much campaigned against all of those failed wars. If you listen to his comments against wars that the Bush administration launched or that other president launched, he made a lot of sense. So someone needs to play those back to him. I mean, the American people are very clear. Every poll shows the majority are against this war. They don't even understand why this war launched and they want it ended. But I just don't know where the president is going with this. He just wants to win and he's digging more. And at the end, I don't think this is going to get him to a big win.
But it's also possible, and, you know, it's a very slim possibility based on nothing scientific other than a hope, that at the end of all this, if and when it's over, that, you know, maybe in that moment of quiet when people kind of, when the dust settles and people clear up the rubble around them, that's when the ordinary people of Iran who don't like the regime will have the courage to go back on the streets and say, you know, we didn't like what the Americans did, but enough is enough. This is our opportunity. If that were to happen, then suddenly Trump's gamble would have been seen to have paid off.
You know, I just think that's not very realistic. I mean, in June of last year, the war, that was one of the narratives of the Israelis, that we're going to come from the sky and we're going to destroy their power and the people will rise up. Not even one protest, because when their people's homes are being bombed and hospitals, schools, the natural reaction is, first of all, you try to get to safety. And if you can, you have to unite with your neighbors, with your fellow citizens. And the same thing is pushed by this war. Yes, there's a lot of discontent and opposition in Iran, and people do come out to protest for their own grievances. But this formula that we're going to go bomb from the sky, and while we're doing it, or right after, people are going to rise up as a result of that, I think is just false. And what happens, it actually helped make the regime even more hardline. In fact, more militaristic. They replaced one Ayatollah Khamenei with a younger Ayatollah Khamenei, right. And now the IRGC is in the driving seat.
I know, and there's actually, you know, there's every chance that that young Ayatollah Khamenei, the Nepo Ayatollah, wouldn't have got that job if it hadn't been for the war, because the Iranian Revolution doesn't like dynastic rule. In fact, one of the reasons it exists was to be against dynastic rule. Just finally, though, I mean, there is a possibility that there was...
Absolutely, I mean, President Trump saying he doesn't want him was the final vote for him.
Okay, just finally, though, Negar, it is also possible, is it not, that, you know, with this continued bombing, at some stage the Iranians will run out of missiles, they will run out of drones. Or do you think they have the ability just to keep making this stuff in a cave?
I mean, these are produced domestically. They have created some form of independent. The reason they're doing it is because they've been under arms embargo. So they don't really have an air force. They don't have air defenses. They don't have fighter just to fight in the sky. This is their only means. But they've been waiting for this day. They've been preparing for this day for years. They're producing them very cheap. Domestically, they're nowhere near ending. And also, let's not forget their other cards. They have opened new fronts in Lebanon, in Iraq, and now potentially in Bab el-Mandab and the Strait of Hormuz. All of these are part of an asymmetric war. And, you know, they are the underdog, but they've been able to play in a strategic way and fight back. And also, finally, they're defending their homeland. This is their neighborhood. When we say the Strait of Hormuz or Khargan, we have to look at a map. This is off the coast of a vast coast of Iran. They have a lot of spots. You know, it's just impossible to go and free the Strait of Hormuz when you have that vast coastline, and they can just make it unsafe with little drones or some kind of missiles that they continue to produce.
Indeed. We've said it before and we'll say it again. All it takes is for one drone to hit one tanker, and whatever agreement has been made, it's all shut down again. The insurers will run for the hills, the tanker operators will be scared, and that the world economy is back in the chokehold that the Iranians have put it in. Nega Mortazavi in Doha, thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. Hope to speak to you as well. I'm meeting all these wonderful new guests on this show. And we're going to get to your calls, of course, in the next hour, which will be about the splits within the United States. There's a lot of stuff going on internally in the US as well. And of course, the reason why we're in this mess is partly because we have an erratic president who is never contradicted by anyone around him, right? This is a circle of sycophants. And how does that work out for their future? And of course, our future, because as we know, what happens in Washington doesn't stay in Washington. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. It's now just a smidge after noon, which means it's time for the news headlines with Dominic Ellis.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Iran has renewed its strikes on targets on Israel and the Gulf states, including on energy facilities. Officials in Kuwait say a missile has damaged a power plant, while a gas site in Abu Dhabi has been forced to close temporarily after being targeted earlier. Tehran also claims to have shot down a US fighter jet. Military analyst Sean Bell says any repercussions would be huge.
If the pilot is captured by the Iranian authorities, can you imagine the propaganda coup that they would get? How would this play for President Trump? It would buy the Iranians a lot more influence, and therefore there's all sorts of suggestions that the Iranians are laying traps at the moment for Western aircraft.
The US hasn't commented on the claim, but described a similar Iranian post on social media last night as false. Officials in the Ukraine capital Kyiv say the country is under another rolling aerial daytime attack. The bombardment is the second time this week Russia has followed up an overnight barrage with heavy strikes. Executives at Marks & Spencer are urging the government to do more to tackle a rise in retail theft and violence. Bosses have warned that shoplifting and attacks on staff are becoming more aggressive and brazen. It follows incidents of so-called link-ups, where groups of young people arrange to meet using social media before surging into shops. Rab Donnelly is from the shop workers union Usdaw and has spoken to LBC News.
I dare say they think that retail workers are an easy target here, or they're going in to get products that they need. And it's wrong. We shouldn't be seeing it this day and age. But we know we're under a cost of living crisis. However, we know it's through organised crime also, and it's for people to feed habits they've got. And this is a real concern for us.
The Home Office says it is giving police stronger powers. A man's been arrested on suspicion of burglary after he was found sleeping in a child-sized bed in Newark. The 24-year-old was woken up by officers responding to reports of an intruder during the early hours of Wednesday. There was no one else at the property at the time. And thousands of Easter rail journeys will be disrupted this weekend by a partial closure of the West Coast Main Line. The six-day shutdown starting from today will impact services between London Euston and Milton Keynes. The closure is part of a £400 million upgrade. LBC weather, windy with scattered showers for many areas, some sunny spells and showers in the north and in the east, a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Matt Fry.
So we've been talking about the ripple effects of what has been decided in Washington. And as we know, what is decided there doesn't stay there. We're at the receiving end of all this politics and, you know, the war that's been conducted in Iran, the lack of support for Ukraine, etc., etc. But what's happening inside the United States? How many divisions have flourished just in the last 5 weeks since the beginning of the Iran war? We know, for instance, that the MAGA camp, the Make America Great Again camp, the base of Donald Trump's electoral success, you know, they're not entirely happy about this war. After all, he rose to prominence and then rose to power on a promise of no more unnecessary wars. And a war that hasn't yet been fully explained, for which the reasons are somewhat fuzzy, to put it mildly, is not something that is popular with the American public. And it's also very irksome too many people in the MAGA camp. And so we've heard some of them on the stage very publicly denouncing it, Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, and others, you know, people who are very friendly with Donald Trump and helped him in the past and worked for him in the past, are saying this is not the way we should go. And so there's a lot of open opposition here. And the question is, to what extent will that spread? Or will he ignore it? Will he just carry on? He's, after all, surrounded by people who don't dare criticize. And we see this in these endless cabinet meetings that are basically round robins of sycophancy. I mean, extraordinary to watch. I mean, Kim Jong-un would be embarrassed, frankly, by that degree of subservience. Anyway, let's get a picture of what's going on by talking to Stephen Marsh. He's a Canadian, and he's talking to us from Toronto, but he's also the author of a book called The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future. Stephen, good to speak to you.
Nice to speak to you too, Matt.
So you're a Canadian, so you have your own very particular views on what's going on in Trump's America, and your Prime Minister, Mark Carney, wouldn't be Prime Minister if it hadn't been for Trump laying into Canada and saying you should become the 51st state, et cetera, et cetera. But when, as a kind of, let's say, a benign outsider and neighbor watching what's going on in the U.S., how would you sum it up?
Well, you know, being Horatio to America's Hamlet has always been the sort of Canadian position. Like, we're sort of the witness of the grand madness and glory of the United States. But I mean, you know, the metaphor that I use is that it's sort of like your favorite cousin shows up at your door on a meth binge with a big knife asking for money. Like, someone you've admired your whole life suddenly degrades themselves and degrades everyone around them and becomes a danger to themselves and others. And I think that's what America is right at this point.
Bill Clinton once said that everything that is wrong with America can be fixed by everything that is right with America. Do you think that's still true?
No, it's very much not true. And I mean, I think one of the things that we're seeing is the direct result of the second Trump administration is that American exceptionalism is dying very rapidly. And it's dying. It's dead in Canada. It's dead in most of the world now. And it was a very real force, that belief that Clinton had, even here, until very recently. But now I think, you know, what we're starting to see is that the laws of politics, the laws of history actually apply to America just the same. I mean, that was the premise of the next Civil War, is that this was a country that had structurally the same attributes of countries heading to civil war. The only thing that didn't stop it was that it was America. But I don't think that actually matters anymore. I think we've seen that what's happening in America is exactly what happens in countries heading towards collapse.
Okay, so just trying to channel the founding fathers here for a minute, or certainly the few optimists still left talking about America. What happens, though, if, you know, the midterm elections, assuming they go ahead, and I think we can probably still just about make that assumption, if they return a Democratic majority both in the House and the Senate, then that's real power to try and curtail the president's executive power. What happens if, well, it's already happening, you know, the judges are basically, and the lower courts are putting up guardrails to what the president can and can't do. The Supreme Court tends to rule in his favor, but not on everything. So, you know, the press is still free, even though Trump wishes it wasn't. I mean, the institutions of democracy are still functioning, aren't they?
Do you hear how low the standards have gotten for you there?
I know.
I mean, like what we're talking about here is a general slow slide. I mean, first of all, if the question of what happens in the midterms, which is not set, let's say there's a Democratic, will the other side regard it as legitimate? I mean, what we are seeing is the slow degradation of all institutional life in the United States. I mean, the firing of the general yesterday was actually a pretty perfect encapsulation of that. You have the deprofessionalization.
General Randy George, as he was wonderfully called. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're seeing the deprofessionalization of the U.S. military, as you've already seen the deprofessionalization of the FBI. You have a slow degradation of democracy. That's it's actually much faster than I predicted, much faster than anyone predicted. And what that results in is a state called anocracy, which is somewhere in between democracy and autocracy. And those are the most dangerous situations for countries to be in. They really are where political violence spikes. So, you know, I think when you get beyond the sort of horse race politics aspects of American life, and you get beyond the sort of frantic Trump nonsense that we're dealing with all the time, the structural problems are really the grave problems. And no one is taking any steps to fix them. No one.
I hear what you're saying, and I'm kind of, as a natural pessimist, I'm inclined to agree with you. But I've also lived in America for 11 years. I have a lot of American friends. My kids grew up there, etc. I have a real, you know, deep-seated affection for the country. And I just wonder, and again, I'm speaking on the side of the angels that have gone into a witness protection program. Is it possible that this can be reversed? Because the fundamental civic spirit of America, you know, it may not be the majority, but it's alive and kicking in so many corners of the country.
Well, look,
Indulge me, Steve.
No. Look, the last chapter of this book is called, you know, the Case for Hope. And, like, the case for hope is ordinary Americans, right? Because, like, I think as Canadians, we actually understand it implicitly. Like, we know they're just not that different from us. They're actually very similar to us. The problem is not them. The problem is their system that is in breakdown. Right. And, you know, that system, the breakdown of that system was predicted almost to a T by George Washington in his farewell address. I mean, he knew what the inherent rot in the constitutional order of the United States would be and called it exactly. The question is, you know, can Americans find their revolutionary spirit? Can they actually imagine a new country? If anyone can, it's the Americans. But on the other hand, I don't see anyone doing it.
Let me stop you right there. I mean, to be fair, these are small examples, but they are examples nonetheless. I mean, you see it among some of the political characters out there on the Democratic side, even if, you know, Gavin Newsom, Governor Pritzker of Illinois, even a few others on the Republican side are slowly beginning to discover that they have a thing in their back that's slightly knotty. It's called a spine. And then you have the citizens of places like Minneapolis, who are saying, actually, we don't condone executions by ICE on our streets, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there are examples. And
those are not really good examples, though. I mean, you know, especially the politicians, like,
you know,
well, listen, the solution for the politicians for Pritzker is they want us. They think if I win, everything will go back to normal. Right. That's a very convenient thought. But like no one is even discussing something as simple as open primaries, which have shown like a vast return to reason in politics in American life whenever it's applied. But it's against their interests. It's against their incentives. And, you know, what happened in Minneapolis, like that was an incredibly brave act, but it did not solve a single problem, the structural nature of ICE or DHS, right?
Structure
is the key, yes. Not these like little fancy stories.
Well, but hang on a minute. Again, to be fair, yes, structure is the key and the structure is in trouble. But, you know, the events on the streets of Minneapolis did lead to the removal of who is that, you know, that
Bongino.
Right, that guy. Who was strutting around like the sort of Joseph Goebbels of Minneapolis. Now, he was removed from that position by Trump. It's now led to the sacking, you know, is one of the things that led to the sacking of Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary. I mean, there are some changes. There are some changes that are happening. I mean, I know this is not structural and it's not fundamental. But I just wonder whether the savior of all this, if there is a savior at all, will be the Republican Party that looks at Donald Trump and thinks, oh my God, this guy who we once liked holding our nose, boy, did they hold their nose, because he was victory for us at the polls, will now, you know, spell the exact opposite. We're going to ding dong ditch him, you know, eventually. And actually, bring it on. Get rid of him and we'll make room for someone else. I mean, that's a possibility. I'm not saying that his successor will be any better. J.D. Vance as president or even Marco Rubio may not be the answer. But there is correct. Again, I don't know why I keep arguing for America.
Yeah, I've turned you into a defender of the Republican Party.
And I'll tell you why, Stephen, because I want the Republic to survive. And so do you, by the way. Because, you know, just as they've got an ocean between, you know, them and us, you don't have an ocean between the United States, you know, and yourself. You want that country not to descend into civil war. So indulge
definitely.
Me.
I'm very curious why you would think a decade of Republican concession would suddenly change when they've literally collapsed for like a decade. Like, why would they suddenly find a spine? And also, just to be clear, Trump is just a symptom. Like the rod is an accelerator, a catalyst. He's a catalyst, but he's not any more than a catalyst. Mm. Like the structural problems, the inequality, the sense of illegitimacy in the government, the decline in trust in the United States, the lack of solidarity, the fact that Americans feel that other Americans are immoral.
Yeah.
Like all of these deep questions are not going away when Trump is gone. And whoever comes, you know, I mean, one of the most fascinating things about this period in history is that we always seem to think that the current moment we've reached is the bottom and that things are going to recover now. Like that's not how this works. Like it's not how a drinking bender works. It's not how your cousin on meth works. Like things are, what we're in right now is about to get worse.
We're nowhere near the Betty Ford Clinic, are we? I mean, the
exactly.
I mean, I remember, you know, we used to think that Donald Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense, as it was then rather innocently called, under George W. Bush, was the worst of the worst, when he said things like, stuff happens, you know, over Fallujah, or, you know, he talked about the famous known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. I mean, this is mild-mannered academic speak compared to the kind of, you know, stuff that we hear from Pete Hegseth at the moment. It's a different universe altogether.
I remember when George H.W. Bush, 3 days of the news cycle were consumed by the fact that he checked his watch during a debate and was therefore too incompassionate to be president. I mean, that was in my lifetime. Right now we're in, you know, Hegseth is there because he has good hair.
Listen, because right? that's so unfair. I mean, he's there because he's got incredible strategic acumen. And by the way, he's dealt with his alleged drinking
his
issues.
Drinking, yeah.
He's dealt. Sure. I mean, anyone who says in their congressional hearings, confirmation hearings, I am dealing with my drink problem should not be allowed anywhere near the nuclear button. But that's another matter for another day. Steve, final one to you, because you are a Canadian and, you doff your hat to the king, our king, your king, you know, the king. The king is on his way. Isn't that ironic? The king is on his way to Washington to celebrate 250 years since the republic turned its back on a king and has now been run by a president who wants to be like a king. Do you think the king should still go? Not that you have a vote in the matter, none of us do. But do you think he should go? And if he's there, what should he tell the American president and the American public?
I mean, you know, he's there as an entertainment figure, right? He's the original entertainment figure. And I mean, I think there's something actually pretty great about having the royal show up on the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, just to be sort of, you know, you could have chosen this path and it probably all would have worked out better for you.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I mean, this is where 250th anniversary of the American Republic is its low point. Right. I mean, it's never looked, monarchism has never looked more attractive than it has at the current moment.
I suspect, Stephen, that he might not be saying that in the speech that he's probably is being written for him right now by the Prime Minister. Stephen March, author of The Next Civil War, The Dispatches from an American The American Future. Thank you very much. That was a pleasure to talk to you. Coming up, Donald Trump is back in his firing spree. This time it's Pam Bondi that plays the victim, the U.S. Attorney General, a loyalist through and through who reshaped the Justice Department but still failed to please a president fixated on prosecuting political enemies, is gone. We'll be speaking about the fallout from that after the break. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is 12:18.
This is LBC. Here's a tale of two commuters. Steve was in a rush and needed to park near the station. Jane also needed a space and booked in advance with Your Parking Space. Steve had a meeting at 9 and panic at 8. Nowhere to park. Jane, she's already in the office and enjoying that morning latte. With Your Parking Space, you can browse thousands of spaces across London and reserve the perfect one instantly. Get £10 off your first booking. Download the Your Parking Space app today.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Cancer doesn't care about childhood. It doesn't care what they miss out on or how much you want to protect them. But we do. At Great Ormond Street Hospital Charity, we fund life-saving research, vital family support, and the special things that help seriously ill kids be kids.
until no childhood is lost to cancer. Join us. Search GOSH Charity.
And when teams feel supported, they can achieve anything.
Sorry. Just had even more of my teamer off ill.
Have you tried Benenden Health? It's easy to set up. They've got a GP helpline you can book 24/7.
Where were we?
A coffee break, hopefully.
Press play on your people's health with a wide range of healthcare services for less than £16 per employee per month. Search Benenden for Business. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
Matt Fry on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Okay, let me just read you this Trump on Truth Social just last night. Pam Bondi is a great American patriot and a loyal friend who faithfully served as my attorney general over the past year. Pam did a tremendous job overseeing a massive crackdown in crime across our country, with murders plummeting to their lowest level since 1900. We love Pam. And she'll be transitioning to a much needed and important new job in the private sector, to be announced at a date in the near future. In other words, she hasn't got one yet. And our Deputy Attorney General and the very talented and respected legal mind, Todd Blanche, Trump's former personal lawyer, will now step in to serve as Acting Attorney General. Thank you for your attention to this matter. I love the way he signs off all his posts with thank you for your attention to this matter. Well, thank you indeed for your attention to this matter. Toulouse Olorunipa. She's the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, author and entrepreneur who works, who works as a staff writer for The Atlantic. Toulouse, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And thank you for getting up so early. And thank you for your attention to this matter. So,
of course.
Indeed, I love that. How significant is the, I guess we could call it what it is, the firing of Pam Bondi?
This is a pretty significant development. The Attorney General is one of the top cabinet officials in the U.S. government. And the fact that Pam Bondi, who had tried to be loyal to Trump, had tried to follow through on his desires, that she prosecute his enemies and protect his friends, nonetheless found herself on the outs with him and was not able to meet up to his high expectations for using the Justice Department to become a political weapon against one's enemies. And so she finds herself without a job, being ousted, kind of in an unceremonious way, even though Trump tried to flower, you know, put flowery language around her, saying she was the best ever. But she was fired in a way that, you know, basically was tossed away from the government without, you know, a lot of dignity. And so it shows that Trump is looking for someone who can prosecute his enemies in a very blatant way and protect himself and protect his friends, to be in this position, which traditionally has been independent from the White House, but the president wants it to be a wholly owned subsidiary of the White House, prosecuting those that he does not like.
Which is a really significant point, and we'll get back to that in a minute. But are you saying then that it was more important in the decision to fire her that she didn't go after his political enemies than her botching of the Epstein files?
I think it was both. The Epstein files was definitely a sour note for this administration. The president was very unhappy about the Epstein files and how much it implicated him and how much those files sort of continued to be in the news. And we continue to see stories about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And so that was a big part of why the president had soured on Pam Bondi. But we also have heard from people within the administration that the president was unhappy that many of the prosecutions that he's called for against his enemies, like the former FBI director James Comey and the New York Attorney General Letitia James, people who have gone after him and been part of, you know, prosecutions against him, the president wants those people to be prosecuted successfully. And most of those prosecutions, you know, fell apart because of the lack of evidence and were not able to move forward. And the president was very unhappy with that as well. And so it was a mixture of different things that led to Pam Bondi becoming persona non grata in the Trump administration, but definitely the Epstein files and her inability to successfully prosecute the president's enemies were high on that list.
I mean, far be it for me to defend Pam Bondi, but I mean, I guess the reason why she couldn't bring, those people couldn't be brought to book at the end of the day is that, you know, there was just such a flimsy case against them and the courts threw it out.
Yeah, exactly. The fact that these cases were brought in the first place is itself a scandal. The president's political enemies being brought up on charges that did not have any real evidence backing them up. That's not how American justice traditionally has worked. And obviously the court systems stepped in to stop, you know, a grave miscarriage of justice from happening, by sort of tossing out these cases and calling out the lack of evidence. But it shows that any person who goes into this role of attorney general is going to have a really hard time trying to meet Trump's demands, because he wants to see his political enemies behind bars, being found guilty of various crimes. And he doesn't care that there's not a lack, there's no real evidence to back up many of these charges. So I would buckle in and sort of wait for the next person to see how aggressive they'll be in trying to manufacture some of these charges against the president's, you know, political opponents. But if the court system works the way it should, it may be very difficult for them to have more success than Pam Bondi did.
And, you know, despite all the criticism of the Supreme Court and despite the fact that Trump has been trying to politicize the whole judicial system in his favor and against his supposed enemies, do you think the court system in America is working the way it should do?
Well, it's not designed for this kind of presidency. It has done what it could to try to, you know, put some guardrails around this presidency. But there's so much in the American system that is really based on honor, not necessarily black and white letter of the law. And the court system tends to move relatively slowly, while this president has decided that he wants to move very quickly in issuing executive orders and expanding the use of executive power. So sometimes it takes the courts a while to catch up and to put the brakes on certain things that the president wants to do that may be unconstitutional or otherwise illegal. But the courts are in a moment of transition where they're trying to adjust to this version of a presidency that does not respect many of the constitutional guardrails that previous presidents had. And so it's an adjustment period. The courts are doing what they can for now, but I think many in the judicial branch realize that they're going to have to make some changes to adjust to this new era of a presidency that's sort of steeped in executive power and looking to push the boundaries of the law on many fronts at once.
It's so interesting what you mentioned there about a system of honor, because I lived in America for quite a long time, and I was always struck by the extent to which, you know, politicians and presidents from all political sides worshipped, or at least said they worshipped, the Constitution. And they went back to the founding fathers and to the parchment papers that underpin, you know, the most powerful republic that, you know, we've ever seen. But I wonder whether the Constitution is as outdated for today's politics with a guy like Trump in charge who probably never read the document or doesn't certainly respect it in the way that other presidents did. Is that as outdated as using a 17th century medical manual on a heart operation?
Well, definitely there are times where it has been difficult to see what the founders of this country, those who wrote the Constitution, would have thought about this current moment and the fact that they definitely could not envision a president like President Trump. Now, the Constitution has been used in modern day cases, and we've had justices interpret it in a way to try to, you know, use it in a modern way and make sure that it's not fully outdated. But it is a difficult thing for the justice system at a time when we have a president who does not have those same regards for some of those founding ideals. It's hard for the justice system to adjust to that. But, you know, for the most part, many of the most, sort of constitutionally questionable things the president has tried to do have been blocked by the courts, and the president has respected the court ruling. Now, if we get to a point where the president is defying court rulings, then we get to a constitutional crisis, the likes of which the founders and the Constitution itself may not be ready for. And so as long as Trump is abiding by court rulings, listening to the judges, and not trying to use the power of his office to overrule the judicial branch, the, you know, constitutional system that the founders created is holding up. And despite being, you know, more than 250 years old at this point, is still sort of doing the job of keeping the constitutional republic intact. But if we get to a point where we have these constitutional clashes between the different branches of government, we could be in a pretty dark and dire place where we may have to figure out how to navigate a modern assault on the constitutional principles that founded the country.
I mean, just one final one, and I hear what you're saying, and I hope, you know, let's be optimistic, and let's hope that actually the system does work, and that we won't get to a place where he's, you know, stopping you know, banning the midterm elections or tries to run for another term of office, which personally I doubt is going to happen, but you never know. Just finally, there's this, you know, this again, I'm sort of fascinated by Pete Hegseth, the so-called Secretary of War, as he likes to call himself, firing the chief of the staff, the chief of the military staff, General Randy George, overnight. He's supposed to serve in office for another year and a half, and he's got rid of him. As he, you know, stopped the promotion of African-American and female generals to one-star generals. I mean, he seems to be more interested in fighting his war on woke than fighting an actual war that he started.
Well, he's definitely, he feels comfortable in the realm of, you know, anti-DEI policies and going after the media and going after people who he believes are, you know, in positions that they don't deserve based on their race or gender, than he is in the position of leading, you know, this huge department in a time of war. Because he doesn't have the experience of previous secretaries of defense. He has not been in the military leadership role before taking the highest position in the military. Yeah. And so it's not surprising that he's sort of zeroing in on the things that he's comfortable with and not focusing on the actual task of the job, which is to keep the country safe and to prosecute the wars of this country and to navigate the issues of war and peace in a way that's prudent. And so I'm not surprised that he's focusing on these ancillary issues. And I wouldn't be surprised if he continues to do that even in the midst of a hot war.
Yeah. I mean, he's a breakfast news anchor, let's face it. Nothing wrong with being a breakfast news anchor, but my ambition is never to run the mightiest military in the world. You will be relieved to hear. Toulouse Olorunipa, thank you very much indeed for coming on the program. Lots of texts coming in. Here's one is Caroline Levitt asks Jason, is she about to get the heave too, Matt? I doubt it, frankly. And then someone here says, great show with Matt this morning. Such well-informed guests and intelligent discussions. More, please. Checks on the way. Thank you very much for that. And also, on that note, intelligent discussion, I want more of you. I want to hear some callers. You seem to have gone back to your, you know, inside your Easter egg. Come out. Talk to me. I will get you on the air. I will give you your chance to talk to the nation. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is now 12:32, which means it's time for the news headlines with Tim Humphrey.
Iran claims to have shot down an American fighter jet. The US has so far not commented on the claim, but described a similar Iranian post on X last night as false. The government's being called on to do more to tackle shoplifting. The head of retail at Marks & Spencer says there's been a surge in violence and theft, and stores feel powerless. Four NASA astronauts are getting some rest on their 244,000-mile journey to the moon. Orion's expected to reach its destination and carry out a lunar flyby on Monday. LBC weather, rain and drizzle clearing everywhere but the south. There could be some sunshine in the north and a high of 16 degrees.
This is LBC.
How does a $20 golf gadget end up being used as a bomb detector in war zones worldwide? I'm Alice Levine and this is Explosive Lies, the podcast exposing a scam that fooled governments and security services across the globe. Open our free Global Player app and search Explosive Lies to start listening today.
And when teams feel supported, they can achieve anything.
Sorry, just had even more of my team are off ill.
Have you tried Benenden Health? It's easy to set up. They've got a GP helpline you can book 24/7.
Where were we?
A coffee break, hopefully.
Press play on your people's health with a wide range of healthcare services for less than £16 per employee per month. Search Benenden for business. Fee reviewed periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
Interactive Investor would like to say welcome and thank you. Welcome to all our new investors who joined us over the past few months. And thank you to a certain competitor that decided to change their fee structure and sent them all our way. Visit Interactive Investor to see what you could save with our low flat fee. Interactive Investor. I think, therefore I. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less. Irish Ferries, see you travel differently. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with Matt Fry. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Lots of texts coming in. Let me just read you this one. A house divided against itself cannot stand. A second American Civil War inches closer, says Al in Sunderland. I wonder. Lots of other texts coming in. And please do call me. 0345-606-973. We only have 25 minutes left together, so make the most of it. But also, I want to focus for the next 10 minutes on the other war. The war that is much closer to home, that is the one waged by Russia against Ukraine. When that war started, I was in Kyiv and we wondered, would this last? First of all, we thought it might be over in a week, like the Russians hoped it would be, because, you know, they would go in with overwhelming force. And of course, we were quickly disabused of that and realized that the Ukrainians were more resilient. They had a plan. They were unified in their message and they resisted. And then we thought maybe, what would it last? A few months, maybe a year or two. Today is day 1,500 of that war. 1,500 days of that war. So just imagine when we're talking about the Iran war, you know, we're into week five now, sorry, week six soon, tomorrow. Could it be another 2 weeks or 3 weeks? I would be very careful with any predictions, especially if the American president decides to send ground troops into Iran. Then we're into an entirely different ball game, as they say over there. But I want to focus on Ukraine right now. So let's talk to Damian Shevko. He's the defense correspondent for the New Voice of Ukraine. He's based in Kharkiv. Damian, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm fine. I did not realize it's 1,500th day today.
Yes.
Actually.
Yeah, no, it's that's big news in the UK. I guess you're so used to this now, especially in Kharkiv, that you've stopped counting.
Yeah, that's insane. And these few days were also quite tough. So Russians responded to our Easter peace proposal with swarms of drones.
So yes, so
we're telling.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? And there's so many things to talk about. But first of all, I want to start with Ukraine's perception of what's going on in the Iran war and how Ukraine has kind of got itself into an interesting position. So here we had the American president, soon after he came into office, insulting your president in the Oval Office. I was there when it happened. It was shocking to see. You have no cards to play. You're going to drag us all into World War III. You're losing this war. You know, give it up. You know, come to some kind of deal. And now we saw the American president basically go to the Ukrainians a few weeks ago, cap in hand, saying, can we please have some of your drone interceptor technology to deal with these Iranian missiles? And then, of course, he changed his tune again and insulted Zelensky. But I noticed that Zelensky's been talking to the Saudis and the Bahrainis, I think, and the UAE about giving them some of the technology that you guys have developed to prevent the Russians from firing rockets and missiles. Well, so what can Ukraine teach, I hate to say it, Iran in this war, but also the Gulf states that are caught in the middle of all this?
You're absolutely right that Ukraine found itself in a very new, I would say, situation for Ukraine. Ukraine never been on the top of this military, military production, military technology. But now it appears that this complicated ecosystem that Ukraine created to survive starting from 2014 is very handy for wars like Gulf War, and for it looks like the future wars will look like this. And not only American companies, but also European. Also, I know for sure that Saudis, Pakistanis, so they are all interested in, for example, interceptor drones. So they have a cheap. So you don't need to spend $2 million. But just a few thousand for a very cheap drone, which is quite effective. So
indeed, and when I was in Kyiv, one of my many trips there, kind of 3 months into the war, you know, I was asked to see some of their drone manufacturing, and they showed me this warehouse on the outskirts of Kyiv that was full of what looked like toy drones, and I said, "You're not going to defeat the Russians with the kind of drone that I would might buy my kids for their birthday or Christmas. But actually, these are exactly the kind of drones, I mean, modified. But these are drones that cost maybe, what, $3,000 a pop that are able to take down a Shahid drone coming in from, from Iran even or from Russia. I mean, this is very cost effective. It's a lot cheaper than a Patriot missile.
Absolutely, absolutely. They're very cheap even too. So some of them are up to $1,000. And if you look, you know, how Russia-Ukraine war, you know, develops. So the end of this war is not in diplomacy, but in our economics. So we already see the growing pressure on Russia's economy. And they have a huge deficit last year. They will have even more higher deficit this year. And I did some, you know, rough math. And, you know, it's interesting, for example, too. So this, a week ago, commander of Ukraine unmanned forces, Robert Brody, he said that to kill one Russian soldier cost less than $1,000. Mm. So now Russians at this stage of war, Russians lose up to 600 people for 1 square kilometer. So if you make some simple math, you will understand that, and Russians pay for cost per soldier. So they pay for recruit approximately $10,000-$20,000 upfront, then add $2,000 monthly salary for whole army.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a lot.
That's a lot, and then they pay more than $100,000 for killed soldier to family. So, so we spent less than $1,000 to kill one soldier, and they spent at the same time $120,000. Mm. So that's 1 to 160 efficiency.
Okay, let me just ask you there. I mean, but they've also got many more men than you have. It's a much bigger population. Do you buy this estimate that has come out of a number of intelligence sources? I think also Ukrainians, that the Russians are losing either to death or injury 30,000 men a month.
It's not killed, but also killed and seriously wounded.
Yes, that's what I meant. Yeah,
approximately yes. And new defense minister of Ukraine. So we have now like technological this business approach. So the new aim goal KPI is to kill 50,000.
Mm. Right.
So the idea is to kill more than they can recruit.
Okay.
And then.
Yes, and they are, even they may be running out of men eventually. But of course, the Iran war has helped them enormously in terms of the lifting of oil sanctions and the fact that the price of oil has gone up. So we estimate, or the markets estimate, that Russia will make as much as, I think, is at $8 billion extra US dollars a month as a result of this war. That is bad news for Ukraine, isn't it?
That's bad news, but you know there are different. I also follow this, you know, this situation. But that's not for certain, because there are many nuances. So Russia lost its main market, Europe, right? Then they have very big problems because Ukraine is hitting their oil refineries and these ports. That, for example, Baltic ports, this Ust-Luga. So we don't know whether they can, you know, just sell it, whether their possibilities. But of course, this might help them to stay endure longer. Mm. But it will not save them in the end.
Okay, one final question to you is, and this is a theory of mine that I've just developed in the last half an hour, so it may be absolute rubbish. If the Americans or if Trump comes good on his threat to leave NATO, which I would not rule out at all. I think that him leaving NATO means that Ukraine gets into whatever is left of NATO, because the Europeans on their own will realize that they need all the help they can get. And there is no better equipped, no more experienced, no more determined army right now than yours. So this is my theory. What do you think?
Absolutely. NATO or maybe some another organization that will appear instead of NATO. Absolutely.
Okay. You agreed with me. That was so simple. Damian Shevko, I wish you all the best. I know that Kharkiv is very close to the front line. You're getting whacked every other night or so, and it can't be easy living there. You spend probably far too much time down in the metro station. So I wish, yes, you're nodding. I wish you all the best. He's the defense correspondent for the New Voice of Ukraine, and he's based in the city of Kharkiv. The second city in Ukraine, and a wonderful place it is too. Okay, coming up.
Macron, whose wife feeds him extremely badly. And still recovering from the right to the jaw.
Sometimes he is quite funny. You've got to give him that. Emmanuel Macron is the latest world leader in the firing line. Not just his wife's firing line, but Donald Trump's firing line. We'll be chatting about where that relationship between the US and France now lies. They used to be great allies. General Lafayette helped the revolution. What's happened? I'll take your calls as well. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC The Time. It's 12:45.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Will young people sign up to serve in the armed forces? Reality TV star and former soldier himself, Harry Clark, tells LBC he wouldn't now. Pope Leo urges Israel to end its war on Iran.
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas, and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1 or via post. And for this week only, we're also guaranteeing 5 winners of £20,000 in our bonus draw. Enter by midnight on Sunday to be in the draw. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only, no purchase necessary.
Are chocolate eggs truly bound to round? No. Waitrose have unveiled a rich number one Ruby Fruits flat egg, sprinkled with dried berries, a tangy marvel in confectionery, and the number one blonde chocolate almond croissant egg, topped with milk chocolate and crunchy roasted almonds. Chocolate eggs are only the beginning. Indulge in a range of Easter treats at Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands, Little Waitrose and Partners and concessions.
Take Irish Ferries from Dover to Calais, where your pet travels in the pet lounge. You'll be barking not to. Irish Ferries. See travel differently.
Oh, Fiona's back at the monkey safari again. She's hooked on Toyota Service and Aftercare. In fact, it's so good, she'll find any excuse to come back. From replacement wipers to service and MOTs, our perks include free refreshments, quiet workspaces, courtesy cars, and a new warranty with every eligible service. Toyota Service and Aftercare. So good, you'll find any excuse to come back. Eligible services are available until the vehicle turns 10 years old or 100,000 miles. T's and C's apply.
Matt Fry on LBC.
Okay, so here's a text from Woz or Waz who says, Matt, I love the show, but you're not getting enough callers on. You're right, I haven't. And you know why? You know why? Because for the first hour, the page was blank. You were all in the witness protection program. Anyway, I brought you all out, and now the page is literally lighting up like an early season Christmas tree. So let's go to Veronica and Sutton. Veronica, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Matt. So much you've covered today. I could talk about probably everything. But the one point that hasn't been addressed today, and it triggered when you talked about Bondi being dismissed, was yesterday was the news that the Army's chief
Randy
of
George.
Staff...
Randy George. Yeah. We talked about him a little bit. What do you think? Is that significant? Yeah. It is, isn't it?
Well, it is because, I mean, because the checks and balances of the U.S. Government, my hope was like, well, at least at the Pentagon, there must be some decent generals preventing Hezketh and Trump, doing sort of criminal attacks in Iran and everything. And then as soon as, yesterday you saw they've destroyed bridges, they've destroyed, the Institute of Pasteur Institute that they
the medical institute, yeah.
You know, they're attacking civilians, and the voice of reason. I was hoping that George was the voice saying, well, you cannot do a land invasion, you cannot put boots on the ground. It'll be it's a suicide mission. So my concern is now, and I've just read actually, he's Hesketh has put in a lapdog. You know, he's a former assistant or something. So I'm just wondering, you know, at what point? I mean, it seems like conspiratorial theory talk about, you know, sort of civil war or something. But at what point? Because you're far more familiar with this, is the U.S. system, the military system, or somebody going to say, stop, enough is enough?
Well, they may do, and it's possible that, you know, Hegseth is being read the riot act as we speak by senior brass in the Pentagon, but I doubt it, frankly. I mean, it is a political system where the generals are given orders to carry out, and there's absolutely no sign so far that the generals might say, well, the politicians have gone too far, we need to rein them back in again. You know, that's the kind of thing that used to happen in Latin American countries, and maybe, maybe we'll get there at the end of the day, but there's no sign of that at all at the moment. And I do know from good authority that Trump absolutely loves his Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, because he looks great and he talks tough. But the kind of stuff that he says, you know, is frankly as out there as some of the stuff that Trump says himself. So when Hegseth sort of makes fun of the idea that you have international laws, that there is a rule of law even in war, you know, he talks about pearl-clutching Europeans. I mean, this is, again, it's designed to humiliate the allies. And it's designed to, you know, to snipe at the doubters. And it's also designed to, you know, to kiss the president's posterior. And it so far seems to be working. Anyway.
So who can stop him? What's the next? What are the checks and balances? Where is getting rid of all the general or anybody else who could stand up? Hmm.
Well, it's a good question. So I think within the Trump White House, the only person that I see who can really stand up to him is Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, who is, you know, she's recovering from cancer at the moment, or she's fighting cancer, so she may not be as strong as she was. She's a Trump groupie, but she ultimately, I think, you know, almost like the sort of designated nanny in the White House, I think has a degree of control over him. But whether she can see the bigger picture, she's a Florida campaign politician, I don't know, frankly. I mean, she was a friend of Pam Bondi. She got Pam Bondi into the administration, and now Pam Bondi's gone, so maybe her own position has been weakened. I'm just guessing. We're all on the outside of the Trump court, you know, the court of King Donald Trump. So your guess is as good as mine, probably. Veronica and Sutton, thank you so much. Okay, let's go to Emmanuel, the issue of Macron versus Donald Trump. Now, I remember there's a wonderful story I heard once from the French ambassador in Washington, who, when Macron appeared in the first Trump administration in front of Congress, where he'd been invited to speak, and he spoke in fluent English, as he likes to, and said, "There is no planet B." That was the famous line from that speech. And he was attacking Trump. And the host had invited him over to the US for his environmental program, for ripping up the Paris Climate Accord. And then after that, Emmanuel Macron went back to the French ambassador's house, the residence in Kalorama, a very fancy part of Washington. And there was a phone call on the ambassador's phone from Donald Trump for Emmanuel Macron. And the ambassador handed Macron the phone, and Macron was assumed that he was going to get a bollocking from the president. And in fact, what Trump said was, "Well done, Emmanuel. They loved you. They loved it. They gave you all this round of applause," which kind of made Macron wince and wonder what was going on. And now, of course, the relationship has broken down. Macron is no longer the Trump whisperer. Trump has insulted his wife. He's insulted France, which is not the first time that's happened. Remember, they used to call them French fries, freedom fries in the Iraq War. And I remember talking to a guy in a Texas cattle auction once, as the French were trying to stop the war from Iraq going ahead. He said, "I'll tell you something about the French, but it ain't real nice," he said. I always remember that. Let's go to David Chazan, France correspondent for The Times. David, how serious is this spat? Can they make up, or is that it?
Well, Matt, to repeat what you said, your guess is as good as mine, because with Trump, you just never know. But what is certainly true is that Trump's been mocking Macron for months, and it seems that his patience has finally snapped with that latest jibe against his wife, the comment about the right hook. He's still recovering from that right.
Was that it then? So you insult the wife, you insult the man more than anything else? Do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's trying to portray Macron as being weak, and he's also pointing out that he's not going to remain in office for very much longer. Well, hey, that's the way democracy works. Presidents come and go, and Macron is constitutionally barred from standing for a third term. But nevertheless, he is still very active on the world stage. Now, his popularity at home has fallen a lot, but with this latest spat from Trump, even Macron's bitterest domestic enemies have lined up behind him, with the far left party saying this is unacceptable. We don't agree, we disagree on pretty much everything with Macron, but we're behind him on this.
That's so fascinating, isn't it? I mean, there is the Trump effect that is basically making opposition politicians or politicians in trouble great again. Mark Carney would not have been elected as Prime Minister of Canada, wouldn't even have entered the race if it hadn't been for Donald Trump's acerbic rhetoric. In this country, Nigel Farage is having a tough time because of his association with Trump. And Keir Starmer's best moment so far as Prime Minister has been, you know, when he said there's a very clear line between us and the Americans on this war in Iran. So I wonder what effect Trump will have on domestic French politics a year ahead of presidential elections. Is he helping Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella, or the opposite?
I think the opposite. I think we saw that in the recent local elections just last month, when Marine Le Pen's party did far worse than it was expecting to. It took a lot of very small communities, so it's got a lot of mayors now of villages and very small towns, but the breakthrough it had expected in French cities didn't come. And one French commentator summed it up beautifully, I think. He said, Donald Trump is Marine Le Pen's worst enemy right now, because she has been too closely associated with him in the past. Both she and Jordan Bardella have been at pains to distance themselves, first over Trump's tariffs, which hit the French wine and agricultural industries quite hard, then over the war with Iran. But nevertheless, I think that Trump has damaged them. So with a year to go before the presidential election, it's looking a lot less certain that either Jordan Bardella or Marine Le Pen might win, although they are still leading in the opinion polls.
Has the other side, I mean, the centre-left, the centre-right, have they decided at all who might take on Jordan Bardella or Marine Le Pen? There seemed to be no clarity on the issue a few months ago when I was in Paris.
No, but there's a lot of jockeying for position, because the fear is that you've got too many candidates. A lot of people like Edouard Philippe, who is a centre-right candidate. Mm. He was Macron's first prime minister. He's since somewhat distanced himself.
He's suffering from cancer, isn't he? Surviving cancer, or trying to survive it? Is that
no,
right?
I think he's okay. He's got vitiligo, but I think his health is okay.
Right.
He's mayor of Le Havre. He's just been re-elected, and he's already declared that he is going to be a presidential candidate. The problem is, if you get too many candidates from the centre-right, the centre and the centre-left, all competing with each other for what we might call the mainstream vote, you split the vote for the traditional parties, and you could end up in a situation where you get, say, Jordan Bardella or Marine Le Pen facing off against a far-left candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, in the second round, which would be like having Jeremy Corbyn versus Nigel Farage.
Mm. Okay, fascinating stuff. David Chazan, thank you very much indeed for joining us from Paris. Peter in Hackney, you have 50 seconds to end this programme. Lucky old you, Peter.
Lucky me. Yes, so my point in a way is related to the last one, but it's to do with the Democrat Party in America.
Yeah.
I listen to a lot of LBC, and I don't follow American news, but it seems that the American Democrat Party as a totality seems absent. There's a lot of talk about guardrails for the Constitution and Constitution and laws, but I have no idea if they have a leader, if they have a policy, if they know what sort of party they want to be.
Mm.
And I'm just wondering if that's a misinterpretation, seeing as I don't follow...
Well, I think you're broadly speaking right, but I think there have been some Democrats who've been much more vocal in recent months. One of them is the governor of California, who has, you know, quite a big brain and great hair, presidential hair, some people say. You never know. Keep an eye on him, a guy called Gavin Newsom. Then there's the governor of Illinois, who doesn't have such great hair, but he's smart, and he's really, really, really rich, which might also help. Anyway, we've got to leave it there. Pete and Hackney, thanks for your call. Thanks to all of you for calling in. I've got to leave it for now. I'm back tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, so you haven't quite seen the end of me yet over Easter. Coming up at 4 on LBC, Simon Marks over here. But right now, sitting in front of me, Sheila Fogarty.
Thanks,
Sheila,
thank you very much. Lovely to see you too. Thank you very much indeed. I think there was a very shrewd observation by Peter there, don't you, at the end of the programme.
Absolutely.
Yeah. At 3 today, traitors winner and former soldier Harry Clark has been telling me all about his recent meeting with Pope Leo. Good Friday seems like a good day to discuss faith and religious belief, which is growing among young people, we are told. I'm going to talk more about drilling in the North Sea. I have completely lost track of what is right and what is wrong, who says what, and who says why. So we'll go back to that too. The Pope has spoken by phone with Isaac Herzog, Israeli president, urging a return to dialogue. Easier said than done, I suppose. But can the Pope change hearts and minds in the Middle East? And as Britain looks to increase our defences, will young people join up in sufficient numbers? Harry, aforementioned, former soldier, doesn't think so.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Iran claims to have shot down an American fighter jet. The US has so far not commented on the claim, but described a similar post by Iranian officials on X last night as false. If confirmed, it would be the second time Iran has hit a US fighter jet in 2 weeks. Meanwhile, the US has bombed Iran's largest bridge. Iranian state media says 8 people were killed. Earlier this week, Donald Trump mocked the UK and France for refusing to have further involvement in the Middle East conflict. Former British National Security Advisor Lord Ricketts has told LBC the relationship between the UK and the US is more strained than ever.
The way Trump has behaved, first over Greenland, now over Iran, and the insulting of Starmer and other European heads of government, you know, really has knocked the stuffing out of NATO, which is an organisation that is built on trust rather than treaties.
Police have confirmed a 14-year-old boy was shot dead in southeast London yesterday afternoon. Two boys, aged 14 and 16, and an 18-year-old man have been arrested on suspicion of murder following the attack in Woolwich. The victim's family is getting specialist support. A man's due to appear in court charged with murder after two people died in a house fire in East London 2 years ago. Murder charges were authorised against 25-year-old Algerian national Fouad Baldra more than a year later before he was arrested in France in January and extradited to the UK yesterday. Around 40 firefighters were called to the fire in Walthamstow in April 2024. Executives at Marks & Spencer urging the government to do more to tackle a rise in retail theft and violence. Managers have warned shoplifting and attacks on staff are becoming more aggressive and brazen. Groups of young people are arranging to meet using social media before surging into shops. NASA says its astronauts are in great spirits after setting off for the moon. They fired their spacecraft's engine for the next stage of the journey. Space expert Dr. Kevin Fong has told LBC about the mission so far.
This crew is going further and faster than any human has gone in more than half a century. And this mission is going amazingly to plan so far. I kind of don't want to jinx it. It's going so well. But I have been following it every step of the way and very impressed.
The crew has described the views on board as spectacular. LBC weather, rain and drizzle clearing everywhere but the south. There could be some sunshine in the north and a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Humphrey.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. A Pope and a reality TV star, not automatic bedfellows, are they, that you would consider? But actually, for the purposes of our conversations this Good Friday, you will find that they are. We're going to be talking about what Pope Leo has been saying on war, various wars, but especially the war in the Middle East at the moment. And we'll hear as well, you'll hear a couple of times actually in the programme, from Harry Clark, winner of The Traitors, previous winner of The traitors, but a former soldier himself as well. He's been talking to me about a number of things, not least his recent meeting with Pope Leo. You'll hear more, a lot more about that after three when we discuss religious belief, faith, and especially young people and their faith and whether it's growing. But I want to start with Pope Leo's words on war. They have been incredibly strong, muscular. He has not pulled any punches. He has criticised heavily various world leaders, from Trump to Benjamin Netanyahu to Vladimir Putin. He's really gone for it. He's talked about the evil, as he sees it, that war is. And there's just an awful lot of it in our world at the moment. We learned just an hour or so ago that Pope Leo had spoken to the Israeli President Isaac Herzog, urging Israel to reopen dialogue with Iran. Easier said than done. Should they? Can they? Will they? Does he have the sway, do you think? And I want to know as well whether you would ever fight for England, because we know that defences, our defences, are going to have to be improved. And again, Harry Clark had stuff to say on that. We'll hear from him in just a second. But just I want to give you a flavour, really, of how Pope Leo has been speaking about war and the leaders that wage it. During a Palm Sunday Mass in St. Peter's Square last Sunday, Pope Leo made these comments about the Iran war.
Fratelli, sorelle, questo è il nostro
Brothers and sisters,
Dio.
This is our God,
Re
Jesus,
della pace,
King of Peace,
Dio che rifiuta
who rejects
guerra,
war, who no one can use to justify war. He does not listen to the prayers of those who wage war, but rejects them, saying, even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood.
I mean, I was quite, I had been paying, you know, I pay attention to Rome and the Vatican, and it's an interest of mine. And I'd been conscious of the language that Pope Leo was using about war, various wars, ever since he became Pope. But that particular quote really stood out to me. He was saying, God will not listen to you, Donald Trump. God will not listen to you, Benjamin Netanyahu. God will not listen to you, Vladimir Putin. He didn't say their names, but he's directing it at leaders who engage in war. Now, there's all kinds of discussions we could have about whether these wars are necessary or not. But the language from the Pope is really strong, and it brought to my mind the kind of language you would hear Pope John Paul II use against communist regimes at the time when he was Pope. Really, really similar kind of strength in and politics, essentially, in what he was saying. I know he's a pastoral spiritual leader as well, as much as anything, more than anything, but that was politics. That was politics as well as God, I think. And before I came on air, and you'll hear more from him later, I spoke with Harry Clark, winner of the Traitors second series. He's a former serviceman as well, now reality TV star. Harry met Pope Leo recently following a pilgrimage, and I asked him about his view on the military, former serviceman, remember, and global conflicts after his meeting with the Pope.
From being to Rome and the experiences I've had, it's like put me at such peace. So before I'd go to Rome, if we ever went to war, it's like, I'll sign that dotted line, you know, I served in the military. Now I've actually second-guessed that, and I've really questioned it as to what's the point.
What's the point of what?
Going to war and laying down your life for something that people wouldn't really care if you did or not, you know? So it's funny because since being to Rome and speaking to these people, the only thing I now want is peace.
And to work for that rather than work for...
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, you've kind of half-answered a question I was about to ask you, really, because I wondered, as a young person who has served in the military, we know that our defence needs are growing. You know, not our attacking needs, but our defence needs are growing. What would you say to a young teenager, 18, 19, boy or girl, man or woman, about joining the armed forces?
It's amazing. I think it's not for everyone, but it's amazing if you feel lost. It gives you a sense of purpose, and it gives you a family that you never knew you needed. It also teaches you discipline and the skill sets to go on in life. You know, I left the army now 2 years ago. But the skill sets and the things I learned in the army, I'll live with for the rest of my life.
And yet that doesn't really tally, does it, with what you said before?
Yeah, I know, it's really weird, but I think everyone goes through their moments in life.
I get the skills thing. I mean, it's a great...
But also, you can do anything in the army. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even know that, you know. I just joined the army to be a soldier.
You did engineering, didn't you?
Yeah, I was a helicopter engineer. I'd never seen a helicopter being in Slough. It was only police helicopters. So to actually be an engineer on a helicopter, fix them and fly them was crazy. But you can be a painter, a driver, a chef. So you can learn all these qualities and do it in the army. You don't have to, it's not all scary. It's not just go there and shoot guns. You know, it's, there's so much more to it. You could even be like an admin or a clerk. You can even do social media in the army now. I'm working with them to try and create like a, yeah, like a social media side, presenting side, and then still be serving in the military.
And that would make me join, yeah, what, yeah, you've just said there. However, you've also said, God, you know, particularly since the visit to Rome, you think about peace. You don't want to sign on the dotted line anymore to fight for your country, to go to war. But you're being enthusiastic about joining the armed forces. Can you square that for me?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hypocritical, isn't it? But I think it's because